Hello, and welcome to a very spoilery Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi spoiler podcast analysis discussion chat thing. My name is Chris Thurston, and I am joined by my sister, Rebecca Thurston.
Hello.
That is another. So, yes, we are recording this the day after seeing a midnight screening of Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi. Which ended at 2:30 in the morning.
Something like that. Plus trailers. So
yeah. And then
very much the middle of the night.
Then we talked about the film until about 5 in the morning.
We got a small amount of sleep.
And then we talked about the film from about 10 in the morning until about 5, you know, hang on, about 3 in the evening.
At which point I was supposed to get on a train and leave, and instead we decided to do this.
So explain, obviously, you know, if people have listened to Little Grey Cells, the Creighton Crowbar Pyro podcast this week, they will be familiar with who you are. Beyond simply
the
my
other
sibling. But explain why you are here.
Why am I physically? Because I usually live in America. But for the second time in my life, I flew home early for Christmas with the express purpose of seeing a Star Wars with you. Because I feel, I don't want to mischaracterize this, I feel we very much grew up through Star Wars.
Yes.
It was, we have lots of, cultural touchstones that we share, but like, I think that's the, like, the, touchstone of our, like, pop culture imagination is Star Wars.
Yeah.
And it was always really important to me to see these movies with you. Like, my memory of them announcing that there was going to be a new trilogy was like, fuck, I need to talk to my brother.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, genuinely, like, a little moment in the Force.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, a couple of years ago, I came home, we did the same thing, like, flew overnight, we went to a midnight screening together, and we just did that again.
It's worth stressing that, it's not when you say you flew overnight the night before. So yeah. You landed at, like, what, 10 in the morning yesterday?
Yeah.
And then got a bit of sleep and then came here and went to a midnight screening, which is nuts.
But, and it's my blanket excuse for any opinions I have now that may change later.
Yes, so that's probably worth caveating with. Obviously, this is, we've talked a lot about the film, and actually both of our opinions and takes on it, I think, have matured a little bit as a consequence of those discussions. But also, as ever, like, I'm awaiting second viewing eagerly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And things may well change. I think I can identify, I think I can feel the areas of the film where the hot take engine will find the most fuel. I don't have particular interest in that myself, really, but you know, it's certainly not a perfect film, but we both enjoyed it a lot. We'll go into that in a minute. I was going to say that it's nice and neat for me that obviously we're meeting now for the one time of year that we are in the same place, because normally I occupy a rainy, wet island where I think about Star Wars a lot, but mainly occupy myself with growing a beard. Whereas you live a much more kind of productive life of leadership and achievement within the resistance, as far as I can tell.
That would be perfect. That would, yeah. I would that I were Leia.
Yeah, we can't stretch that analogy too far, but because we're not twins.
We're not twins. The Force is slightly stronger than you. We're both definitely Force sensitive, I
think. Yes, that's true. I am surrounded at all times by puffins. So I thought the best place to start would be with some top level, like, obviously now one day old takes, like, not drilling too deep yet.
Yeah.
Like, movie. How you feel.
Yeah. Me? How
yeah,
me feel?
How you feel.
So yeah, with the caveat we've well established that, like, opinions may settle in transit. I really loved it. We'll talk about this. I had moments where I was nervous. But you can attest this, I was crying for most of the last third. And like, partly that is just like there's a lot of that's to do with seeing Carrie Fisher on screen. But my experience of the last third of the film was being surprised again and again by like how much I was being surprised by and how much I was enjoying it. And that doesn't mean that I want to see it again. I don't know that, like, there might be moments that I could enjoy how cool they were in the moment. And if I see them again, might not hit for me. But I had moments of unsteadiness, and then just, I mean, we're doing spoilers, I can say this, from kind of the throne room onwards, from Snoke's death onwards, like, this is everything is landing for me. I'm sure that's not everyone's experience, but for me, like, you were sitting next to me, you saw my face.
Yeah, I think, yes, I feel similarly. Like, it was a film of consistently individually excellent, moments, lines, surprises. This sounds kind of like back of the box-ish, what I mean is, like, so it's not, it is analogous to Empire Strikes Back in a lot of ways. Some of them very unsubtle.
Yes.
You know, specific set pieces, rebel convoys on the run, being chased by Star Destroyers, escape to a strange neutral place where, you know, we need to get something from an ally. Like, you know, there's a lot of obvious riffs, and maybe we can get back to that in another way. But like the middle sections of all three Star Wars trilogies now, it is more of a kind of it is a single story.
Yeah.
But it is I'm trying to think, not like a pastiche, but like, it's like almost like, it feels in some ways almost like a series of vignettes with like sort of central themes. Like there's a lot of different plot threads all at once, whereas it doesn't have the, follow the droid chase of either The Force Awakens or A New Hope.
Yes.
And, and as a result, obviously it doesn't have the kind of neatness of those stories from intro to hero's journey to blow up the big round ball.
And I think we also experience that diversion differently because it's thrilling in the moment to feel like, oh, they're taking this movie somewhere we're not expecting. I mean, just on a level of like what you expect from a franchise and what we've come to expect, especially like J.J. Abrams did a very good job threading that needle of making you feel like you're in the world of the original trilogy, and making this practical, like making this like physically possible to happen again. But the experience in the cinema of not being able to read the plot beats right away and know where this is going to go is quite thrilling.
Yeah. It's like they redid Star Wars and now they've undone Star Wars.
Yeah. Which is super necessary, but I think it's easy to forget that is that's a difficult thing
to do. And it's a strange experience to have something challenge a story you love in a positive way, like not challenge it by making it shit, which the prequel is true. Like challenge it in a way that actually asks some tough questions about Star Wars' kind of themes while also serving big nostalgia.
Yes.
Like that is the kind of interesting double bind, I think, of The Last Jedi as a whole.
Yeah.
Is like, it is both very interested in your nostalgia and very interested in telling you to kill the past, which is, these are both themes of the film.
Literally.
I don't think they are fully reconciled against each other in terms of the film's external goals versus its internal thematic goals.
And nor are the, like, the figures that it's not mapped onto, like, what is, you know, the people who want the past to be killed in Star Wars are not all mapped onto Ben Solo / Kylo Ren, you know, in this analogy, but it's definitely part of the text of the film as well.
And it's like, but also the thing is as well that it is, despite being so strange and familiar and different all at the same time, like it was consistently like a delight.
Yeah.
And it got me in a big way, like consistently. I think it's very possible to pick holes in some aspects of it, but like I was, you know, for all of the analysis can make this kind of reaction feel quite dry and steady, but actually, like, I was in for the entire time.
We were both, like, I was like, physically shaking from it.
Yeah, yeah. With a moment of concern that we both share.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not alone in that. Every Star Wars film beyond the original trilogy for me has, which I experienced as a kid and therefore with more innocent eyes, has moments where you go, oh, I don't know where this is going. And so, you know, for me, that's the Rathtar sequence in The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
It's the Borg Gullet sequence in Rogue One.
Yeah.
So it's just the weird monsters, basically both the tentacle monsters initially. And we'll get to what it is in The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
And the prequels are just that, basically.
They're just that. And like, this is something we've said before in our every 2 years long conversations after having seen a Star Wars. It's a difficult movie it's a unique experience to experience it while watching it, because you're not just watching a film and you're watching pop culture be rewritten in front of your eyes with characters you're super invested in. And so I think with the Mascot sequence, I remember like after that, future rewatches of Force Awakens, that sequence seemed way shorter, because the first time you're watching it, you're like, where are they going with this? The pace seems wonky because you're like, this is taking a long time. And when you know that it's just like a set piece, it doesn't feel the same way. So I'm really interested to watch this again and get a sense of whether it's laggy or whether the bits that I was unsure about seem to go quicker because I'm not experiencing them in the moment as worry.
Yes, I think that's fair. I think you were right also in a different conversation when you said that we don't just experience like the film, we also experience watching our expectations get resolved. And I think one thing that I find, so I think some of, you know, I've watched some of the reaction today and obviously the film's reviewed very well. It feels designed to enrage a certain type of fan in the way it does and doesn't resolve certain things, and in the way it does and doesn't stick to the quote-unquote rules of the Star Wars universe. I want to get onto that in a bit. There are things that I feel like could have done with a bit more unpacking to land properly.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it is... So, you know... given the furore over by assholes about Ray, for example, yeah. right? Like, it is so uninterested as a film in making her operate as part of the traditional Star Wars power transition.
And that was the moment that I didn't say much out loud in the film, and I went, yes, when
yeah.
they said.
Yes, so, like, obviously, this is a spoiler podcast. Yeah. We've already spoiled one thing already, so we'll just, you know, we said it right at the top. But, like, yes, the most important line in the film is, your parents were nobody.
Yeah.
And as the middle part of this trilogy, as that, you know, that is the only way to do that right. Because now the shocking thing in Star Wars is when someone isn't part of the Skywalker Kenobi lineage.
Yeah.
Right? Like Skywalker Solo Kenobi kind of line. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you are just, you this, he says, you know, this, you know, you don't have a place in this story to Rey. And that, you know, there's probably a separate podcast about the ways in which Kylo Ren's worldview embodies certain aspects of, like, male internet fandom, but like, but there's, you know, there's a, that is the best thing they could have possibly done.
Yeah.
And it's, but it's also, you know, I saw the upset today online from people whose fan theories, you know, constructed over the course of years have crumbled in an instant. And it, the film actively discourages a kind of, detail obsessed fandom,
it can't
I think.
Be, it's not necessarily about like acquisitive, like information protection and like cultivation. It's, it is more interested in its themes, which I think it really pulls.
And
on.
In emotional truth as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's not interested in, and so for me.
Not to say that, I mean, that said, we're diving all over the place. That said, it's interesting in understanding how the Force works is emotional, but still pragmatic in a way that I really like.
Yes. I'm not saying it fully goes one way or the other, but like, it'll be interesting to watch how its willingness to follow a kind of almost magical realist Star Wars, even though Star Wars is already a universe with magic in it, is taken by an audience that, particularly a science fiction audience that, you know, is used to or consumes en masse, 7-minute long YouTube videos explaining the difference between a BTL A4 Y-wing and a Clone Wars era Y-wing.
And it's, and like, I think it's, you know, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. I don't want to suggest it's all part of the same continuum, but like, you know, it is good to get out of midichlorian town.
It is. And if nothing, like, I know we've spoken about this and God, there's so much to get into. A lot of what Disney has done with Star Wars, in the last couple of years, from, Rebels to this, to other side material feels like the kind of coherent moving on from the prequels.
Yeah.
Thematically, in terms of isolating what's important about Star Wars in, you know, The Last Jedi has full on a sequence, which is a functionally a repudiation of midichlorians as a concept. They never mention them, but it's like, this is the Force.
Yeah.
This is what it looks like.
And it's both, I mean, we're skipping ahead, but like, it's emotionally satisfying. And also it's told through cinema. It's embracing the fact that these are movies and it's using your relationship to images and like feeling and like the sense of moving. Like it's nice to remember that like, these are movies and like it's using those logics of storytelling to express something about the Force in a really visceral way, which I was super into. So
we're getting into detail stuff now. So let's move on to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is because there's attacking this film because it's such a complicated film. There's so much going on in it. I think maybe approaching it from a, like a
plot
beat
by character.
I think character by character is probably the way to do it. So,
who do you want to start with?
I want to start with Poe.
What a guy!
So the film opens with Poe, and I really like how they, because Star Wars has a lot of characters now, right? And it kind of needs to differentiate, you know, it's kind of established that these films are not about a central three. Mm-hmm. I think people assumed that.
We've got our new three. It's going to be Kylo, Finn and Rey. Like, Poe, Finn and Rey.
Poe, Finn and Rey. Apart from the fact that, you know, until the end of The Last Jedi, Poe and Rey haven't met yet.
Yeah.
So like, there's, you know, like there's this need to give them all like little arcs. And actually I really enjoyed how Poe is different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's the same, but he's different, right? You see almost like idealized Poe in The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
And you get full on idealized Poe at the beginning of this.
Yeah.
Like one of the ways I would say that kind of like magic Star Wars realism is very visible in this film is in terms of the way that the space battles are constructed. If you compare this to Rogue One in terms of like what one person is capable of doing, Poe is a hell of a pilot.
Yeah.
He is the guy you send in alone to taunt three Star Destroyers.
Through the medium of a prank phone call.
Indeed. to, yes.
Sassy prank phone call.
To sassy, like, there is no sequence in the original trilogy where Wedge Antilles sassy prank phone calls Tarkin in order to distract him while someone blows up some turbo, while he also blows up some turbo lasers.
Yeah.
It's a great bit, and you get to see what BB-8 actually does, what BB-8 is actually supposed to do.
Which again, we talked about this earlier, but it's an interesting example of what it means to have a fresh pair of eyes on like Star Wars material is that example of BB-8 going inside the X-Wing and actually staying with BB-8 while mechanics work happens is something that obviously has always been happening in the universe. We understand what like these droids are for, but like seeing it is just, it's an example of like, oh yeah, perspective is going to take us different places with this, which I think is something that sticks with the rest of maintenance workers and, you know.
Yeah, the camera goes all over the place. Yeah. Right?
And it's interested in different characters in the world that we understand.
And we get like, sort of the folly of Poe, which is something that Leia understands, but has to tell him off for. And I love their relationship because you get a bit of it in The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
But you get...
He's in the sexy fly boy leadership school.
He is.
the sexy older woman, sexy fly boy leadership school.
We'll get to Leia and we'll get to, Holdo, who's Laura Dern's character as well. But I love that the leadership of the resistance is, two women in middle age, like, you know, different ages, but like, you know, two older women.
It's Big Little Lies in space.
Yeah.
Laura Dern playing the same character.
Who have both had to deal with Poe Dameron's shit in the form of multiple different people. You know what I mean? Like, get the impression, like, both of them acknowledge the fact that this isn't the first flyboy they've had to wrangle, which is both a beautiful, like, character note for, like, an older Leia.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Who is, she's sick of that shit when she's, like, 19.
But it's also, like, always attracted to and simultaneously attracted to and sick of it.
She's sick of it. But Poe's sort of heart is in the right place, but his only answer to a problem is to jump into an X-Wing and blow something up.
This is a lovely line.
Which is a lovely line. And also, you know, slightly kind of, it kind of indicates that we're on a journey to, for things to be a little bit more complicated in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like, because I think that idea that it's not always as simple as jumping in an X-Wing and blowing something up is a little bit undermined by often it is.
How frequently.
Although you made
a point earlier that I really liked, which was, we were talking about how both of us were enjoying or reacting to the space battle sequences. And whether they felt like prequely or original trilogy E, and I haven't watched the prequels in a long time. So for me, I was enjoying how, for me, they felt character driven and I could follow them in like a character driven way. And we can talk about it, but like, I did feel like there was investment in some of the other pilots and like the bombers and stuff. And I could, and like that it was like the pace of that action was well directed. But you made a good point about how, it's not necessarily teaching us not to look at, you know, that rather than the model of like, all the call signs and like watching them fight as a unit, we have too much of, just Poe as one man show Poe.
Yeah.
And
the one man Poe.
And so one way to critique that would have been to have more substantial, like the actual unit fighting together. What they did in the movie, which was puncturing it in a different way, was saying like, yes, that's all well and good. You are terrific at that. That's not what leadership is.
Yes. Yeah. I agree. I think, we'll get to some things we talk about plot that I think undermine that slightly.
Yeah.
And I think, purely personally, on an aesthetic level, I will always come down on the side of like, I love getting to know a little bit about the anonymous pilots.
Yeah.
I think you did get introduced to them, but you lose them just as quickly and you don't really see them do anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's no Wedge.
There is no Wedge, right? Or Gold Leader or Wes Jansen or, you know, Dak from, you know, like these sort of side characters that orbit it.
Yeah.
You meet Tally briefly, who's an A-Wing pilot, who's been sort of advertised, like there's merch for a character who's barely in the film, blows up, right? There's, you know, I'd like to have seen a little bit more of them, I think. I think what I'd like to have seen is like Poe's gambit, his prank phone call at the start, open up a hole for his squadron, not just him.
Yeah.
I think that would have been the balance for me.
I'm creating a distraction for the rest of the X-Wings to do something. No, I'm creating a distraction and also I'm going to simultaneously do it.
Yes, exactly.
Like, I'm a hell of a guy.
Just to make, that he is the guy who goes out in front and looks after his squadron, but the squadron was also there, their absence and the fact that it was the Poe show.
Yeah.
I think it sets up what comes next, which is Poe being grounded for like almost the entire rest of the film.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, I don't want to dwell on that too much because it, you know, we've got a lot of characters to get through. but Poe really is sort of on the sidelines and like conducts a mutiny and like, you know, kind of gets a lot wrong. There's a lot about people getting stuff wrong in the central part of the film, which is kind of interesting from a plotting point of view. Mm. They're just wrong about stuff, basically. Should we talk about... Oh, God, who do we... Do?
I think I want to... Maybe should we end with Luke, because I feel like that's the key to the rest of the movie. So who should we do next?
Finn.
Finn
kind of bounces off, because Finn and Poe, obviously...
Yeah. Finn... I want to imagine John Boyega getting the script for The Last Jedi. I was like, my first scene is I'm walking around leaking confusingly. Mm. But no, I was a bit concerned that Finn was going to be underserved, and because this is a spoiler thing, we can go straight to it. The moment that looked like it was going to be his death...
Yes.
Is as satisfying or thrilling as, like, a sacrificial death can be. I felt like it would have been underselling the character and, like, how central he was to The Force Awakens. And I mean this both in terms of Finn as a character, and also, like, pragmatically understanding what it meant to have, like, a black lead in the Star Wars movie, to have him kind of sidelined in the film and then die sacrificially for everyone else was, I was worried about that. And Finn didn't get as much character stuff, with the obvious exception that I think the Rose relationship's really nice, and I think it's an important segue into the relationship between, in theory, people that aren't, like, important people, is what they're setting up as, like, this is what, like, new forms of power is coming through Finn's character and Rose's character.
Yes.
And, like, and that's an, that for me, that's the most exciting thematic thing about Star Wars right now. And that's certainly in his character.
Yes. And it also links into the you come from nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
often,
yeah, that's
often
I mean.
The most important person doesn't come
Precisely.
From somewhere.
And that is way more exciting than Dynasty. And that's really cool. And that is in Finn's arc, as is, you know, it's good having the Phasma stuff. It was the end is a bit silly, as we discussed. It's I have the higher ground because I'm on a lift that goes up and down.
Yes, exactly. I think so. I like that they don't undo, like, Finn's sort of transition to heroism at the end of The Force Awakens isn't undone, but it's like his form of heroism is still running away.
Yeah.
It's just, and Rose misunderstands that, and that I liked as a beat.
Mm.
Like, it's, and to be honest, their mission kind of is basically
that,
a series.
We're going to talk a lot about that.
About a lot about, but, like, it is a series of running away. Basically, it ends with them running away and succeeding, mostly because BB-8 fixes that problem for them off screen.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then he has that sort of, Finn's sort of uncertain. The reason I think his suicide charge is important, regardless of whether or not he dies.
Yeah, the actual impulse to do it.
Yeah. Is because it's the first, he goes on a journey from, even the way I act like a hero is to run away.
To running towards.
Run towards.
Yeah.
That sequence, actually, the charge on the Death Star battering ram. The film is a wealth of giant Imperial guns that need shutting down in a very specific way.
There's always one button.
Yeah, exactly. And this button happens to be in the middle of the gun. I actually thought when it became apparent, when Poe's screaming at Finn to get out the way, I thought that was going to be Poe's death.
Yeah, because we looked at each other that moment, right?
Like,
we both
Poe's
thought that
going
was,
for it.
Especially because he'd just given BB-8 the belly rub of his life, and that's
Indeed.
What you do before you die. Like,
yeah.
Hand goes over with Chewie before
I agree with you. I think that would have underserved Finn's character.
Yeah, but not necessarily Poe.
I think that, you know, if they were going to do a sacrifice there. However, I think, you know, I've seen the comment that Rose saving Finn at the end of the film, undermined the moment, but actually her line,
her line is the way
we fight this is by saving the things we love, not by destroying the things we hate, is like,
whoa. We've got to stick love into the Death Star.
Yes, exactly.
Stick it out of the Death Star.
Yeah, exactly. Just sucking the love out of the Death Star. But like that is, you know, it is subversive for a Star Wars film to have someone so I suppose Star Wars films haven't been big on suicide runs necessarily in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't happen except by accident.
Mm-hmm.
By that one A-Wing pilot, Arvel Krindred is his actual name, who accidentally destroys a Super Star Destroyer by crashing into it. This film has a couple of self-sacrifice moments. Talk about the other one. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of things you can take from that moment and why it's important that he is saved,
mm-hmm.
including the fact that, Kylo Ren's arc is very much about destroying the thing you hate,
mm-hmm.
Rather than saving the thing you love.
Yeah. It's also about not loving. It's about letting go of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kylo Ren is also created in a moment where a character is compelled to try and destroy the thing he hates rather than save the thing he loves.
Yeah.
So
there is
a lot of quite sophisticated theme work in the film we'll get to, but you know, it fits basically is what I'm saying. It's like poetry. It rhymes.
Hey.
Thanks, George.
Georgie boy.
Yeah. So let's see. We should talk about Rose as a character briefly as well.
Yay.
I liked that she's one of the first Star Wars characters that this film has a few scenes like this, because you see both Chewie and Leia and Luke, to an extent, grieve for Han in their own ways.
Yeah.
So there's a touch of grief to that.
Yeah.
But you really do see...
actual
grief. Yeah, actual crying. You see Rose grieving for her sister, who dies saving the fleet at the beginning. And, people don't tend to grieve in Star Wars in the same way, because the big characters, the main characters, tend to get upset, but in the most operatic, it's space opera, right? Mm-hmm. They get upset in a big operatic way.
Yeah.
Like, or they're afforded, like, if you were part of the Skywalker dynasty, when something goes wrong for you, you must bellow and fall off something. You know what I mean? And then you feel better.
Yeah.
Like,
I've had a bad day. I'm just going to chop off my hand and jump off a thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Unless you are named Leia, in which case your job is to, even if your planet has been blown up, is to comfort Luke.
And I have, I'm not going to repeat my monologue from last night, but I have my kind of big, not problem with it, because I can deal with it, but like the thing about the Star Wars universe that doesn't make sense is how society isn't fundamentally changed by the ability to blow up planets. How, like, why haven't the wealthy all gone in to live in ships now that planets aren't a safe place to be? Like,
yes.
Like, the way society works in a world where you can blow up entire civilizations at a time makes no sense. But the point of that is that, like, we don't see the grief either. And I get the kind of, like, shell-shocked thing, but it is surprising that, like, 5 minutes after, like, let's have a medal ceremony and chill out at the end.
Yeah.
My point is that we're going to talk forever, that it is... even if it might seem like a minor beat, having a beat of grief is something.
Yes. And having a character whose perspective is on the ground, who sees the inequality that underpins the Star Wars universe, including the ease with which lives are thrown away by hotshots like Poe Dameron. Yeah. That's a sort of interesting tension to introduce to the heroism of the Republic, like, the resistance, the rebels, there's a lovely moment when they're all cheering and they've destroyed the destroyer, the big gun Star Destroyer at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
It cuts to Leia looking at the display with all of the red X's over all of the ships they lost and how few are left.
Yeah.
And I love that because it is again, it underpins specifically A New Hope.
Mm.
Where only like 3 or 4 ships survive the Death Star run.
Yeah.
They lose so many people.
It's a very small medal ceremony.
Yeah. And good job. Everyone who's left has and then there's cheering and happiness because they're not going to get blown up by the bad egg.
Yeah.
But it doesn't pause to acknowledge that.
My 3 pals survived.
And I think maybe the context is slightly different there because the Death Star attack is like desperately necessary.
Yeah.
And therefore you celebrate the heroes and you remember the dead.
The impossible that this was ever going to happen.
Yes, exactly. It's a miracle that 4 of them survived, basically. Poe's run.
Poe had made a choice to stay.
It was actually unnecessary. Like, this is what we do. We get in X-Wings and we blow up the big gun. It was fascinating that was. Not necessary.
Yeah, exactly. What else is there to say about Rose? She's beautifully played by Kelly Marie Tran. Really like witty performance. That first interaction with Finn is so great. The taser thing.
Yes. Lots of good rebels tasering other rebels.
I really like her character. It's difficult because I think we're going to spoiler for the podcast alert, when we talk about our issues, we're going to talk about that casino sequence a fair bit. That's a chunk of her story, so it's hard to sum up her character without talking about that. But
although
she's not the problem with it at all. I'm just saying that I'm trying to think about what else sticks out about her character other than really doing something really needed thematically, really instantly well realized human character. And her relationship with Finn works for me. I really like it. And the sacrifice works for me as well. So all good.
I think this would be a good place to talk about Leia, because it feels like we're walking almost going by location.
Yeah.
So we're going through the crew of the Raddus at the moment. I like that nod as well to Admiral Raddus from Rogue One. Like that little linking connective tissue was nice. Obviously I have kind of remained upset about Carrie Fisher's passing all year. I loved her as a writer, and I think she deserves, if this is Luke's film to some extent and The Force Awakens is Han's film,
what's the next one supposed to be hers?
I think, well, we wonder, but given the way this thing sets things up for the future, I would have loved for her to get a bigger film than this, because she is also benched.
She's out of action for most of the film. And in a way that suggests that, that's why I get the impression that the third film was supposed to be hers.
Yeah.
Because they flamboyantly bench her.
That said, she does get more action layer stuff that I think she's...
We haven't seen her with a blaster in her hand, so it's not even a blaster, it's like a...
She has a rifle towards the end. Yeah. She shoots Poe with her...
Oh, which is fucking great.
Yeah. In her 90, she shoots Poe with the pistol she has in A New Hope, incidentally.
Yeah, and I like that she has protective bun, like she has her hair in like bun protection.
Exactly.
I've been in space, my hair is being restructured.
Yeah, so that sequence, so we should talk about...
Force Leia.
So things that are great about Leia in this film. One is that you get why she's so important.
Yeah.
Because she is the hero that stuck around.
Yeah.
Han was Han about it. One of the films with the good lines. Luke has been very Luke about it in that he's an island dwelling weirdo.
We will eventually get to the fact that Luke Skywalker is our dad, but that's a later part of the podcast.
But Leia
stayed in the work.
Yeah, Leia stuck with it, and she is good with. There's an interesting. It's her and a Holdo, Laura Dern's character, have an interesting interplay where they are both sort of commanders in a similar position of power, and Leia has a kind of inspirational touch that Holdo can't.
Holdo even quotes her when she's doing an inspirational speech. It's like
And like setting up Leia is she's not. There's a good tension between her and Luke in that Luke is deeply concerned with what he sees as the lie of his own legend.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Leia, is far more measured in her construction of her own legend. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like
she's obviously like esteemed on the battlefield and everyone on that ship knows
hers is a more practical legend than Luke's.
Yeah, yeah.
And Luke lives up to the impossible legend in a spectacular way.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? And I love that. However, shout out to the trailer direction for this. Again, like The Force Awakens, completely misleading. But I was absolutely like, I went cold and speechless when Leia is apparently killed right at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
When Kylo doesn't pull the trigger, which is the thing that the trailer teased he would do. And then the two ties either side of him do. It was just like my heart sank.
Yeah.
And poor Akbar, momentary like rip.
Yeah, rip in peace, Akbar.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the last trap.
Akbar is no more. But like, when she gets blasted into space, I had that like, oh my God, like that's how they're handling this. I thought, you know, at that point I had the sense, you already do have the sense by this point that this film's going to be partly about Ben Solo's internal struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if, his mother being killed by the First Order when he didn't choose to.
Yeah.
Would be something to spare. And my mind started to go in this direction. And I've seen it already attract a lot of criticism, her survival.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like it.
Yeah.
Like, I think there are things about the CGI. I think there are things about the CGI for the entire film that is faintly unreal and kind of...
It didn't always bother me. I think there was a moment when I was like, is this... You're playing that delicate balance of, like, this is always going to happen in like, Hollywood cinema, Western cinema, but, like... When someone floating becomes like Christ-like is a very delicate thing to try and manage, or like when it becomes like whimsically magic. I don't know. It's like, it's a difficult thing to display, but the actual like principle of what you were seeing was really beautiful.
Yeah.
I was just the moment when I was worried about like, is this going to become goofy? Like, is this going to become like, I'm like dragging a clip art picture of Leia across. Whee!
Yeah.
But like it's in the moment I experienced it as being beautiful. I want to see it again and see if it.
Yeah. Like the line that I've seen thrown at it is, I'm Mary Poppins, y'all.
Oh my God. Oh,
which, but I don't think it's that, because I think it's important.
It was graceful,
I like to see, and particularly because this has been Leia's last film.
Yeah.
Like the acknowledgement that she is a Skywalker as much as Luke is, is kind of something that the films have never really gestured at. The books do briefly.
Yeah.
There's a nice, it's a retcon, but it's a nice one, I think, in the, in Bloodlines, which is a novel set 10 years before The Force Awakens, where she's a senator, where she's remembering killing Jabba the Hutt, strangling him with a chain in Return of the Jedi, and it establishes that she accidentally tapped into the dark side of the Force. That's how she's capable of doing it, because she strangles a man who is 100% neck with a chain, right? And it's not like she uses the Force, it's just that, like, the anger and the aggression and the fear empowers her in that moment. That's how she's capable of doing it. Because she does have, you know, the Force is in her, right? Luke even says it in Return of the Jedi. And so I think seeing it in such a kind of serene context, but also such a kind of like inspirational one, like, you know, like she saves herself, which is the important thing.
Yeah.
Like I wondered as soon as you see her hand outstretched again, I wondered if you were going to see something weird, like Kylo leaning out of his TIE fighter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, but like I, yeah, like the actually she is a Skywalker. Yeah. Here she is walking across the sky.
Yeah. Sky floater.
Sky, yeah, no, not that. I like, again, it's this escalation of Star Wars thing. Yeah. That not going to be to everyone's taste, but I think I like it in my Star Wars brain.
Same. I think she's, do we want to talk about her at the end of the film, or do we want to get to the end of the film later?
I think we need to get to the film all at once, because it's where everything comes back together.
Yeah.
So from there, I think maybe to kind of keep things moving along, because there's a, maybe we should try and tie this. I think we're doing sort of themes all at the same time as well. So, because there's so much going on, we won't be able to cover it all, but it might be worth talking about.
Should we go to Luke?
I think we need to go to Luke, Rey, and Ben at the same time.
Yep.
Because this is...
Because all of their plots are absolutely relational.
This is their film.
Yeah.
To a great extent. So I think the best way to do this is just to pick out individual things we liked. So, because the film is so full, and it's impossible in this context to get through like so many small moments of characterization that are individually extremely well conceived.
Yeah.
Like, you mentioned it earlier, but I felt the same thing. The fact that when Rey can't get through to Luke initially, I love that when she hands him the lightsaber, the end of The Force Awakens, he just tosses it backwards over his shoulder, which is a mirror of
Yoda
pulling things out of the toolbox in Return of the Jedi. Like, it's he doesn't give a shit, right?
Oh.
It falls on some puffins.
Yeah.
Or porgs. And like, but I love that, you know, for example, you know, when the door to his hut gets blasted off its hinges,
it's Chewie,
yeah. Not Rey. Because I thought, you know, it's not yet. And it's like Chewie just walks in and bellows at him. Chewie, like R2 and C-3PO don't get a huge amount to do, but they get little important things that are right for them.
And I think it's important that the Falcon always be piloted by a veteran and his fluffy pal. And knowing that Chewie is the fluffiest pal of all, he's had to replace himself with many puffins.
Yeah, exactly. and so there are individual scenes that are probably worth calling out and then putting away again. Like Luke going up to the Falcon again and seeing R2 again was heartbreaking. And R2 playing the Help Me Wong-Yo Kenobi message, like all of this stuff is like, oh, you've
I want to watch that again and see if it seems too gratuitous, but in the moment I was just like floods of fucking tears. I thought that was...
There's so much going on at once, because there is, like, Mark Hamill and Adam Driver, for me, are the standout.
Mark Hamill is fucking incredible in this movie. Like, I cannot say enough about how much I enjoyed... obviously, credit to Rian Johnson for the screenplay as well, but his characterization of Luke in this movie is so satisfying. Every single little moment, like, how he balances like the gravitas of it and the weight of it and its relationship to like the first Luke we met on Tatooine and the fact that he's so cool. Like, I chose that word on purpose. Like, Luke was never the cool one. We always liked Luke, but like, he's your favorite like character, right? In a world where Han Solo is standing next to him, Luke is never the cool one, but like, he's the acerbic edges of his character, like the gesture.
Podcast
moment for like gesture off the shoulder, but like
his last line is pure Han, which is kind of amazing.
Lan Hayed through being a Jedi Master.
Yeah.
And like, this is not interesting to anyone in the world except us, but it's a very strange film for us to watch because our dad has always looked extremely like Mark Hamill, but spends most of the time we see our dad, he's, walking up a hill in a big coat. So it was just our dad.
If he was walking a little black dog, it would have been,
So
I think because Luke, the reason I admire Mark Hamill's performance in the original trilogy and the reason that I like the character so much is that he, in some ways, he is the straightforward, you know, hero whose village burns down and goes on an adventure.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, that process affects him in a really weird way. Mm. Like, Luke is kind of awkward as a, you know, he's a bit weird.
He becomes like, I found religion.
He's very good at things.
Yeah.
Like, he's very, you know, but he is always looking to the horizon. That's the thing. Like, he's always sort of, chasing after him something or not paying attention to where he is, which is Yoda's criticism of him. Yeah. And that's sort of consistent. And he doesn't fit the core dynamic of the original Star Wars trilogy. Mm. It's always thought of as this trio of heroes, but they don't mutually get on. They're like the Avengers. They're not like the Avengers. There's no shot where the camera shows Han, Luke and Leia all operating functionally.
Yeah.
Like, they try it at the beginning of Return of the Jedi.
They stop a bin.
Yeah. You know, they barely work, you know, A New Hope is skin of their teeth and they're shouting at each other the entire time.
Yeah.
Empire, they're separated for the entire film.
Yeah.
And in Return of the Jedi, Luke has changed so much and become so strange.
Excuse me, I have black clothes
now. You know, he's dressed in black. He's strangling Gamorrean guards and threatening people with destruction. And you know, like, he's such an odd Jedi master in a way that the prequels really lost touch with, I think. And then as soon as he gets to Endor, it's like, I shouldn't have come here.
Yeah.
And he goes on his own adventure again.
Yeah.
So the fact that Luke is always leaving, like, he always has his eye on something else. And he's always doing something else. Like, I liked how, I thought it was perfect. Like, this felt very right for Luke to me, that he, even when you trap him on an island, he is still just doing weird things. Like, he's off on the horizon. Like, you can follow him. Yeah. He's going to be milking a fucking boobied plesiosaur.
I mean, again, and like, shout out to Rian Johnson for like, so it's the pitch meeting for Last Jedi. And it's like, so my vision is I absolutely want some teat shots.
Yeah. I want Luke Skywalker to milk that big teat.
Let's show where the blue milk comes from, motherfucker.
Yeah, yeah.
Not all blue milk.
I want to see him go spear fishing.
I do think that works. As strange as it is, I do think that sequence works for like establishing like the limits of his life and how he's going to use his power, and also like Star Wars-y world building. And we will talk about this when we talk about the casino thing, but like, this is a Star Wars film where there's no new planet action for a very long time. So like, seeing him like interact with that world and the battling fish nuns is constantly Rey versus the fish nuns. Like, him interacting with that world is like Star Wars-y and but in a sort of playful, creative way that I was into, while establishing his like extreme nomad. Extreme hermit, that's the word.
Yeah, and you know, there are huge shades of both Obi-Wan and Yoda.
Yeah.
And that is super important because the key beat for this film and for Luke specifically is going to be this. So there are so many things that are strange about this film, but something I think thematically it's very well conceived, and I hope that its legacy is that people keep realizing that for a Star Wars film, actually, despite its plot holes, which we might get to, it's actually, in terms of its themes, it's seemed pretty tight to me.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I really liked about that, and to sort of talk about Luke's arc specifically before we talk about the other two, is that, you know, the key message of this film is said by Yoda. And fucking Yoda, just such good Yoda.
Nice metal entrance.
Yeah. I'm going to set fire to that big tree. It was perfect, right?
Yeah.
It was like, he still has, so the
playful as well. Playful Yoda. Prequel Yoda.
Not prequel Yoda. And like, so the, you know, Luke needs one of his masters to show up at that point.
Yeah.
And needs one of his masters to tell him the role of masters is ultimately
to be outlived
and outclassed by their students.
Yeah.
Like, not just to pass on what you've learned, but pass on all of it and let them do all of it better.
Yeah.
Which is a sort of a bit of a meta kind of message.
Mm.
But the thing I really loved about it is that doesn't boil down to, okay, Luke, you have to step aside and let Rey own this.
Mm-hmm.
It's that in his own arc, he has to exceed his own masters.
Yeah.
And there are two ways this happens that I think are great. Just to get to the end of the film, because Luke has two masters.
Yeah.
He has Obi-Wan. Well, he has Obi-Wan, Yoda, and you could argue for Vader to some extent in terms of Vader's influence on him.
Yeah.
He exceeds Vader, I think, in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
He exceeds Obi-Wan in this because he
does not let himself be struck down enough.
Yes. He denies. Where Obi-Wan's final words to Vader are, if you strike me down, I'll become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. Luke's final message to Kylo Ren is functionally, I am already more powerful than you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And I am powerful in a way that you can't imagine.
Yeah.
His demonstration of power, that extraordinary use of the Force at the end of the film to project an illusion of himself across the galaxy to save the rebels, is and an idealized illusion of him younger, holding his father's lightsaber, which has now been destroyed, like in his black robes from Return of the Jedi, is a kind of power that, and I could unpick this for hours, but like, it's a kind of power that Ben Solo needs to see, which is that like, you can just create the appearance of power.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah,
it's not a ladder you climb. It's a state you pretend to occupy. Legends are just stories, you know, this kind of thing. So his ephemeralness is vital. And the fact that Obi-Wan has to die.
To make that point.
To make that point. Luke doesn't.
Yeah. And he doesn't have to make. Ben doesn't have to have more blood in his hands. He doesn't have to have another Fargo fit.
Yes, exactly.
And that is a gift to him in a way. And I mean, there's, we were talking about, what, you know, how satisfying or unsatisfying is it that he is, like, we were variably using the words force FaceTime to discuss Ray and Ben's interactions throughout the film, but like the projection, of himself, the other two, and I know this is kind of skipping away from what we're saying, but the other two things that we've talked about that, I really liked about that scene. I don't think it's a cop out that it's that he's, you know, projecting himself.
No, and it's completely established.
Thematically, yeah. And the first is what you've just said about what it means to have the confrontation and him apologize to Ben for letting him down, but not let him destroy him. And the other two things, which I, you know, we'll get back to talking about Luke's characterization, but the other two things I love about that being the projection is one, is kind of heartbreaking as it is that it's his last moment with Leia. There's something really in keeping with their relationship that the last kind of depiction of their closeness and intimacy, they're not physically together because that was their condition of them as siblings. Mm. They're so similar and like love each other, but the fact that they aren't together doesn't matter. That's them as children. Like that's their kind of origin story, is that like they were always going to find each other. And so there's something kind of beautiful about visualizing like their non-physically present, like intimacy is really lovely.
Yeah.
And the other thing there's a couple of moments we talked about, like this is a funny film and there's a joke that lands as a joke, but I think is another like thematic thing that's really nice, which is Poe's line of like, how the hell did he get in here? Yes, they figure out that the foxes have got out, but they don't think there's a way out until they think that Luke got in somehow. Mm. So in terms of Luke being just hope, like, literally a new hope, but like in terms of Luke representing like what you can hope for, as soon as they believe there's a way out, they find one. I know that might sound pretty cheesy, but they didn't believe there was one until he came in.
Yeah. In terms of it's poetry, it rhymes, you know, Luke's journey begins with a hologram of Leia that arrives with him after many rebels die to ensure its escape, that ultimately leads him to Obi-Wan Kenobi and the rest of the Star Wars trilogy. Luke's journey ends with him as a kind of illusory message.
Yeah.
And
that secures escape.
Who buys time for rebels to escape. And like he, you know, and even his, like when he leans down and kisses Leia on the forehead, like, now that when you know what happened, you understand that's almost the way he indicates to her that he's not really there because he's incorporeal.
Yeah.
And that's why that helps to explain why Leia isn't concerned that he just walks out in front of all of the AT-ATs in the world. Yeah. but even that has some of the kind of similar sort of body language of her original message, the stoop and the kind of like the, it's really beautifully done. As big as it is as well. Mm. The other thing I wanted to say in terms of Luke and his masters is Yoda, even in this film, reiterates the, you know, always looking to the horizon, not paying attention to where you are. And there's a great, so Luke simply doing what Yoda says in that moment would be him pulling his X-Wing out of the water. We've seen it's down there. Pulling his X-Wing out of the water, getting in, flying to the battle at the end, and sacrificing himself. Mm-hmm. Luke, exceeding Yoda, is both managing to stare into the horizon
And stay be where he is. Yeah.
Like, there's, you know, that's his final, like,
that last shot is so good.
That is the kind of the apotheosis of Luke Skywalker, like, he's there, you know, it's not a binary sunset this time. It's just one massive sunset and he is there and he's done this thing. He is kind of, he says at the beginning of the film, I'm not going to stride out in front of the First Order with a laser sword. I'm going to die on this island. And like he keeps saying, he keeps saying to other people,
everyone that was right. Yeah.
Like, and that he doesn't do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
also just, maybe for a moment, we should just also acknowledge that sequence. We've unpacked well, like what it means that it isn't what we think it is, but it is fucking badass in the actual sequence itself. Like that fight is beautifully choreographed. And again, it succeeds the point of like not have the fight make sense.
Yes.
But it's also fantastic to look at.
There's, because you haven't watched Rebels yet.
No.
I'm not going to say much. Mm-hmm. And I also, I would advise people watch Rebels if they're interested in the kind of new Star Wars being directed, even though it's a kids show. I don't know how much they talk to each other, although I know that the Rebels creative team have become a kind of important part of mm-hmm. the story group generally, because they're doing quite a lot of good work and seeding stuff, basically. Mm-hmm. And obviously the apparatus of the film is very much occupied by the film team, but that sequence has a very specific mirror in Rebels that cannot be an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And it is I don't want to say too much, but like, I was like, oh shit. Like they do a similar thing in Rebels. Cool. In a way that's really neat. And Luke becoming one with the Force at the end didn't sting as much as Han's death did, I think, because like it's kind of right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And also he's not out, like he can totally come back. If Yoda can come back, sit on a little log, laugh a lot and blow up a tree, then.
His last words to Leia are like, no one's ever really gone or something like that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And exactly, we've already had Force Ghost Yoda. Oh man, we haven't talked a lot about, the filmmaking side of it, but who's the DP on this? I forget who, but like that shot itself is really lovely. There's a lot of really beautiful individual stills and like, the cloak flying away in the sunset. Approved.
Yes.
Good.
Definitely. We should talk about Ben and Rey.
Yeah. We're calling him Ben, which I realize is a choice.
I think this is the Ben Solo movie.
Yeah.
I think Kylo Ren is the thing he affects.
Yeah. We don't know what the next movie is, but this is a Ben Solo movie.
So maybe the tie into the Luke, like I found the explanation of how Ben became Kylo satisfactory, although it worried me at first.
There's sometimes you have the problem with the Empire or the First Order that we're just a lot of people who like wearing black and being in power and speaking in a British accent. And, not clear, like as much as hunger for power is a kind of universal kind of motivator you can ascribe to baddies. And as much as we live in a world where a lot of the people that we have in power right now don't seem to care about dressing up their evilness fucking right now. It can be difficult to have like, to really get your teeth into the character motivation of the Empire or the First Order. And I find psychologically that image of Luke standing over Ben with the lightsaber, which every time you see it reads differently,
see it three times.
Yeah, the idea that someone who is dealing with like incredible power and his relationship with the Jedi and the Republic, seeing in that moment that one, he's profoundly vulnerable to people who love him, supposedly love him, and also that like in the moment seeing like, oh wait, the Jedi's are absolutely full of shit. Like what better reason to train with the most powerful people you can find if the Jedi's are just as hypocritical?
Yes.
Like, if they're both essentially after the same thing, but the Jedi's are hypocrites, why not train with Snoke?
Yeah.
Get
out. Go to someone who is outside of this system.
And ultimately, why not be far more attractive than that? So in that moment, you can see why, okay, well, the next best teacher is the First Order. I'm not worried that this is like morally compromising, because they're all fucking morally compromised. But the dream, like the next step away is, get the hell out of all of this. You're all compromised. And so that's the possibility of Rey to him, someone who comes from nowhere, doesn't have these allegiances, is as powerful as him, is profoundly seductive and makes so much sense from that base. And I think that's so well done.
Yeah. And like, so like, I love that Luke's moment of weakness, is interpreted by Ben forever as an attack.
Yeah.
Like, but it's not, that it is just like Luke slips for a moment. Yeah. He's not brave enough to make the decision that, Rose makes at the end,
yeah,
to try and save the good thing.
Yeah.
And like, whether or not you feel like Luke should be able to slip or whether he should be ideal, because he's the guy who redeemed Darth Vader, is a tricky one.
Yeah, but like, so far his special power has always been like relentless belief in the good of people.
Well, I mean,
and so it makes sense that like his big failing is like a slip.
And also to some extent, he wavers throughout, like in Return of the Jedi, he digs deep into the dark side to beat Vader in the first place, and then throws his lightsaber away. And so that Skywalker legacy, that like hot and cold, yes and no,
up then down, in then out,
of them kind of, is within him as well.
Mm-hmm.
So him considering it for a moment when Mark Hamill plays that scene beautifully, the kind of like, I was so ashamed of myself for even thinking about it.
Yeah.
But by that time, it's too late.
Yeah.
Like, there's that is human enough to make Kylo's sudden and abiding fear and hatred of the Jedi and Luke specifically believable.
Yeah.
What this is, and this has been said, but Kylo Ren, Ben Solo is Anakin Skywalker done right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with a far stronger actor, obviously, yeah. and a far more compelling reason
yeah.
for him to be afraid
yeah.
and cynical
yeah.
about the Force and the Jedi.
Yeah.
You know, going full space fascist, yeah. like, there are things, so I do, we'll get to Ben's characterization. So, his sort of, like, yearning for some kind of understanding or approval that he doesn't get from Snoke,
mm-hmm.
Because Snoke feels like he's got him at the end of a chain. One part of Snoke's downfall is that he underestimates
mm-hmm.
Ben. But also, you know, he looks for approval. Like, you know, he watches Hux, who's a character we don't have time to dwell on, but Hux kind of gets the kind of the cookies from Supreme Leader that, he does it, you know what I mean? There's yeah. this, and it's, some of it's petulant, but some of it's also like, you know, he is lost in this system, you know what I mean? And then through Rey, he finds like someone else who doesn't know their place in all this.
Yeah.
Like, obviously that's explicitly Rey's journey, but I think it's Ben's journey as well. It's like, where am I in this system? Because
mm-hmm.
he's, you know, then that beginning of the film, he seems to like have no place within the First Order, yeah. really. Like, he gets in his own fighter. He's not sent against
yeah. Yeah.
his mother's capital ship. He just gets in it himself
yeah.
and then flies all the way there. Blows some stuff up and then doesn't fire.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's so, you know, like, and so I liked his, cause his uncertainty, it comes across in Force Awakens as well. And that thing, and then the way that it's meaningful that he finds that connection with Rey, who by comparison, like, we'll get to Rey, I think, but she is far more certain about what she wants
yeah.
than Kylo Ren is. Yeah. She is kind of like Luke.
Yeah.
A straight arrow.
Yeah.
She just goes for the thing. You know, she, her kind of mechanical understanding of the Force at the beginning of the film is one of its nicest touches. Yeah. Like, oh, it's the Force that allows you to mind control people and lift things. Like, you know, and then he hits her with a fern. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this,
fern thing, yeah.
Like the, Ben's uncertainty, you can see why he finds a sort of, I don't mean attracted to, like, sexually attracted, but like, in why he is drawn to Rey
yeah.
specifically.
And it's a nice way, I mean, this is a sort of side point, but like, her faith in people, even if it started with the kind of like, I'm going to find my family, with her original kind of faith in people. But a lot of that is like focused through Finn. And that's like, even though we don't really see them together much in this film, her, of course she's not going to tolerate for a second any kind of like, she's not going to tolerate like leaving them behind. And that's, even though they don't like emphasize it like a lot, like that's another way that like that first relationship between Finn and Rey remains really important, because it's her first connection to Han and like everyone else is through like we'll get into like the thematics of like biological family versus just like love and like find and like connection between people. But like, there's a reason that of course she's not going to abandon those people. And like, and a lot of that is like the stuff that's set up from the beginning of the random chance encounter of her and Finn and their like relationship anyway. Like there's a nice way that he remains like thematically relevant, even if she doesn't say, of course I'm not going to abandon them because like I have connection between people is all we ever have. And they're over there.
Yeah.
Which Ben doesn't have, I guess is my point.
Mm. So like their kind of developing understanding framed against her fractious relationship with Luke.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, it leans on some of those parallels in that, you know, Luke goes off to face Vader against Yoda's wishes and
yeah.
Rey goes off to face Kylo Ren against yeah. Luke's wishes. The way that resolves, and we should zoom in on the throne room scene,
because
this
is,
people are going to talk about this for a long time, partly because this is a 12A
yeah.
and dudes get stuff chopped off them.
And you know, I can imagine, I want to see this with other friends. I can imagine seeing this with someone and like them not liking it or like having moments not work for them. I guess, as I say, like our opinions may change. I would be so fucking surprised if I ever find that moment anything other than
it's
incredible. It's so good.
Like,
and I want to like, everyone who doesn't like this film, if they don't like that moment, I want to like have a chat. Because
Yeah. Like, so, obviously, so I think, so start with the only thing I don't think works about it is there are beats in it that are too similar to the Emperor's Throne room conversation from Return of the Jedi. Down to, look at your
Rebel fleet. Put your Jedi weapon next to me.
Yes.
For a little while.
Put this on the chair to my arm.
Chekhov's Jedi weapon next to me.
Why do we sound like Papa Lazaru from League of Gentlemen?
It's real.
You're my wife, Laura.
Oh God, sorry.
So there's, you know, look at the fleet. It's being destroyed, all that stuff. What works really well, I think, is like everyone has a different sense of what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
even though they're all people who think they've seen the future.
Yeah.
And I wonder if they all saw the same thing. That's my theory, is that all of them saw Kylo and Rey
fighting together. Oh, that's a nice idea. I know you all interpret it differently.
Yeah, so yeah. Kylo sees it as Rorschach. Rey helping him yeah. overthrow Snoke and yeah. take over the First Order.
Yeah.
Out of greed, because she comes from nowhere, so yeah. therefore she must be desperate for yeah. power. Rey sees Kylo yeah. overthrow the First Order yeah. and join her.
And Snoke sees them fighting together.
And Snoke sees them fight together. So, you know, there's...
That's a lovely idea. That's nice.
So, because what Snoke doesn't see is... So, I'll put it this way. So, shall I explain my Snoke
thing? I think it's right. I think it's important.
So, certainly people are going to be upset that Snoke, such a powerful character capable of linking minds through the Force in order to deceive them, isn't explained in terms of where he fits into the Star Wars universe. He just sort of is. In a way that sort of the Emperor just sort of was until he was very much explained. However... While Rey coming from nowhere, I think is thematically vital, Snoke kind of just existing, mm-hmm. I find a little bit hard, in and of itself, a little bit harder to swallow because there's a sort of like, he's so powerful, you know, he's so incredibly powerful. Surely the effect of a being like this, you know, I mean, where did he come from, right? This ancient, you know, extremely powerful, seemingly more powerful than the Emperor Force user. And, there's been a theory for a very long time that Snoke is Darth Plagueis, who's Palpatine's master. And that, so I'm not a big fan of like headcanon kind of like just making all the dots line up kind of stuff most of the time. However,
in this case,
I think in this case, the film leaves that sort of to be stitched together, probably by a book one day.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding of it, my first kind of like headcanon kind of thing that I think, put it this way, if I was stitching this together, this is how I'd put it, right? If Snoke is Darth Plagueis, that means that Snoke is his, like Palpatine was mm-hmm. Darth Sidious's mm-hmm. politics name.
Yeah.
then rather than his Darth name.
Yeah.
Then that kind of, that can work. He certainly looks a lot like the descriptions of Plagueis in the book covers and stuff like that. The reason I think this goes from being simply like, oh, it's cool because it links to the lore, to being like possibly thematically super useful is because this film deals a lot in themes of old patterns of abuse, mm-hmm. like old cycles of mm-hmm. abuse, and specifically deceptions and lies mm-hmm. and the lie of this kind of power.
Mm-hmm.
In Revenge of the Sith, not a good film, but, you know, Palpatine turns to Anakin and says, you know, the legend of mm-hmm. Darth Plagueis the Wise. He found a way to cheat death.
Mm-hmm.
I would love it if Darth Plagueis' actual thing wasn't quite cheating death. It was, you know, in some ways, the way you really cheat death is you never enact power yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You manipulate.
Yeah.
You, yes, you work through other people.
Yeah, you always have a proxy.
Yeah, you always have a proxy. You work through other people.
Mm-hmm.
And manipulate them and mm-hmm. deceive them. Mm-hmm. And your power is always expressed through others, even though you're at the end of the chain. You're never the person at the top.
Yeah.
Palpatine thinks he killed Plagueis. That was an act of deception.
Yeah.
Palpatine then lies to Anakin about that.
Yeah.
And this means that the Sith are connected by a chain of lies that stretches.
That's their, like, genealogy.
That stretches from Plagueis to Palpatine to Vader to Ben Solo and back to Plagueis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that means that his defeat comes because Ben is much more powerful than he thinks,
mm-hmm.
and he is capable of lying to him, with the truth.
Lying to him with the truth because through the medium with which Snoke manipulates people, which is like looking into their mind.
Yeah.
So because he, I mean, you talk this through, but it's such a good moment.
Yeah, like, so he points the lightsaber at Rey and begins to turn it into position. At the same time with the Force, he rotates Luke's saber to point at Snoke.
Yeah.
And then he will ignite it and kill his enemy.
Yeah. And Snoke senses that he's going to use a lightsaber to kill his enemy.
So it is this act of, you know, truth.
Yeah.
That kills him. And the thing I love about that is it's both So killing your master is a Sith thing.
Yeah.
Overthrowing a Sith is a Jedi thing.
Yeah.
The Ben's act
is both.
Is both. Yeah. And that's like, fucking yes. Like that, like, and there's, yeah, so that for me works if Snoke is Plagueis.
Yeah, same.
And the reason that then becomes kind of important to the story is Plagueis' death, if that's how you want to see it, and Ben's taking up of the First Order as his own thing explicitly to end the Vader thing, the original Anakin motivation to end this shit forever, is essentially the end of the Sith. This is called The Last Jedi, but that is kind of like the end of the Sith. He doesn't take an apprentice. He offers it to Rey, sort of. It's not clear what their relationship would be if she'd said yes.
Yeah.
But that's the, you know, let the past die.
Mm-hmm.
That the Sith loop is closed.
Yeah.
With
that.
That's why in my mind it's important that Snoke be tied to the Sith in some way, so that his death can close a system.
And that is so satisfying that I feel like it would be a bit of a cop-out just to like bury that in a novelization.
To some extent, but also I don't think the movie needed it.
True. Yeah, no. I just think because it works thematically so well, like, is there a reason to, if they are planning to make that text, is there a reason to do that in the next film rather than this one, you know? And maybe there is, you know.
Maybe there is. Maybe there isn't. I think the sort of, it felt like, because it's a film of endings and kind of new beginnings in a big way. And so I think, like, that's why I would like it to be tied up in that way.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you have this sort of weird thing where, like, the Sith sort of ended with Vader.
Yeah.
But then this other guy came along. He wore a yellow bathrobe and used force lightning and manipulated
kind of
people.
Shiny, like,
But he wasn't. And he was just sort of there.
His face was a bit weird.
Yeah.
Sounded like Andy Serkis. Yeah.
Like, that, you know, I think for it to tie together, having that link would be the most elegant way to do it, I think.
Should we do a moment just to say that fight sequence is beautifully choreographed and like, really good. And that shot when they like go like back to back and the frame rate slightly slows and you get like a sense of the tableau without it just being like too much. And it's just, it's a spicy meatball.
It is a spicy meatball. You joked before we went in that the film was just going to be like an hour and a half of people lightsabering porgs.
I did joke that. And there is a moment where porgs find Anakin's thing. And it really does look like one's going to switch one off and fully fry the other one.
Well, I was surprised by the amount of mileage they got out of this film of lightsabers being switched on into people.
Yeah.
Like Snoke, like that. Like, obviously it's 12A and Star Wars has always had dismemberment.
Yeah.
But like Snoke's death is...
Yeah.
Brutal. Yeah, like, even when bits of him still falling off when Hux finds him later.
Fans of Little Grey Cell's last episode will note that there's a gratuitous shot of Valentine, the murdered woman in Poirot, being very dead in a weird way that is kind of echoed in Snoke.
Yes. Maybe it's just because we saw them very close to each other a bit. Even like, and then that final thing of Rey throwing Ben the blue saber and him just igniting it over
that's
his arm into the guy's
cool.
face is but just like, fuck.
I have no interesting take on this apart from that. It was really cool.
there are echoes of the old New Jedi Order stuff in the new films. It's very different now. It's very different. But there are moments where it feels like my old conception of what New Star Wars would look like in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And this for me was like, the cinematic realization of what I imagined like Jason and Jaina Solo being like.
Oh god, yeah.
And
oh man.
And like that's not who they are, really. But
no,
like,
but for that moment before the next scene, like you get that sense of
What does it look like when there are two of them?
Yeah.
And also, like, I lots of things I love. God, this is going to be a long one, but
I'm fine with it being a long one.
Yeah,
we'll keep going. I hope you are too.
Yeah.
if you're still with
like,
us, I'm,
I love
I'm,
I something I loved from I love their fighting styles, something that I felt was deeply missing from the prequel trilogy where the acrobatics came first and the personality of the fighters came second.
Yeah.
So, something that
Rey is fucking scrappy.
Rey is very physical, which I think is a really nice way of, well, explicitly, I think it is a nice way of presenting a female warrior.
Yeah.
Like,
and also her physical sense of the force at this point, like her understanding of the force as being like kinetic and like,
beat things up.
Yeah.
And so she is like a brawler.
Yeah.
Like the bit where she basically like wrestles a guy and like slowly cuts his head off.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's, and Kylo is a more of a swordsman, but very angry.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's a lot of smacking the floor with his lightsaber and stuff. And like it's a showy kind of anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great that those two themes are still in that fight sequence, even after, like, because when the two of them fight in The Force Awakens, Rey's physicality is what overpowers Kylo Ren. Because he, you know, she that fight ends with him forcing her, like, his lightsaber into the ground, not with the force, but with muscle.
So strength. And basically, he is injured and everything, but yeah, it is pure strength from Rey.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, there's, and so seeing them do that together was just rad. I think, so I would like to talk about Ben's, obviously he does a heel face pirouette to some extent. And he ends up, and so his new, like, I'm the supreme leader now. So I, with, so while what it'll say is the discussions we've had in the day that's passed since I saw the film, I have, come to understand more why he might want to be the leader of the First Order.
Or as we're calling it, New Order.
Yes. He founds the band New Order.
Because Joy Division is dead.
yeah, the last Joy Division.
Hey!
I understand it now, right? Like, I think I get it now, because I think his desire for, like, certainty and an end to this, you know, structured power. Sorry, an end to this sort of conflict of lies and betrayals and hypocrisy and all of that. He sees the end of it in the gleaming white authoritarian certainty of the First Order. That kind of makes sense to me now, particularly when you consider that, he's powerful, but quite easily undone by, false perception.
Yeah.
He's manipulated by Snoke and he's manipulated by Luke at the end as well.
Yeah.
Like, that's how Luke undoes him. It's like, like, see ya, kid.
That's interesting. Oh.
Yeah. Like,
I think, I mean, there's, we talked about this earlier, but, like, I also wonder, there's a bit of leeway, in the writing of episode nine with, it's ambiguous whether he's leading the First Order or whether he's just taking advantage of, like, being able to, and now they're going to be what he wants them to be. Like, what their goals are going to be is unclear at this point. And, the idea that, like, in this power vacuum, he just sees the opportunity just to literally just, like, take over their arsenal, essentially, and, like, make it, there's ways to start something new, and one of them is just, like, take over the thing and have a new vision. So there's also the possibility that, like, it's not necessarily, it could be, being attracted to the cut and dry nature of their conception of power. It also just could be the pure opportunism of, like, I'm just going to make this in my image now.
Yeah, that's true. I wonder, so I do find that in the new trilogy, I have a little bit less of a clear sense of how the universe works than I did in the originals.
Yeah.
And I think that's because, you know, the Empire is in power in A New Hope. So, and there are references to the Senate, even though it's disbanded, the Moffs, like, you can sort of see the structure of how that world holds together. Yeah. Whereas, the balance of power between the Republic, the First Order, and the Resistance
is unclear.
It's very hard to gauge.
Yeah.
Like, particularly when apparently every First Order ship is all there chasing the rebels very slowly.
Well, and even, like, the title crawl tells us, like, the First Order are, like, doing great. And I'm like, okay, like, so the last time we saw them, they literally just lost Starkiller Base. So, like, it's the sense of, like, how much power they have and where and, like, what's going on with them is kind
of... Yeah, and how every planet has fallen at the same time. Yeah, and, like, you know, obviously the Republic fleet is gone, but, like... You know, are they really, you know what I mean? Like, the balance of it. And that for me makes it harder to, I do think it makes this side of the story a bit harder to.
It's also the great potential of what they're doing with, I think we'll probably end talking about this, but, what it means to start really gesturing towards, this is going to be about people on the ground starting to have ideas about where they are, how they interact with power and what that means.
The real First Order was late capitalism.
Well, it is. but you know, it's, there's something to be said for, like, if, I think it's a flaw that it's so foggy, the sense of who has what power, but it also is potentially, it may allow, like, a kind of third way.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I think it sort of asks you to take stuff on faith a bit.
But like, yeah, we really don't know, like, literally, like, physically what planets are occupied by whom and how does this actually work? Like, what does life look like in this galaxy? Like,
yes, I think because, and we'll get there eventually, weakest part of the film is the thing you see when you see a planet where life goes on.
Yes, the only glimpse.
Yeah, and it is by far the weakest part of the film. That means that you don't get a sense of what's happened to, like, what's going on Coruscant.
And that's stakes. That's what they're fighting for.
Yeah.
Like, in principle.
Yeah,
right?
What is going on Coruscant? I'm not arguing for another, like, snapshot across the galaxy to see all the locations you've all seen before, but, like, you know.
Watch Jar Jar Binks cheering on top of something.
Yeah, like, that I think is a bit unclear, and that lack of clarity undermines Kylo's supremacy.
Yeah.
It's again, yeah, like a lot of the things in the new films, they work from a character point of view.
Yeah.
And don't stand up under kind of like hard sci-fi scrutiny, I think. Like, I did want to mention quickly, maybe before we move on to Rey a bit, although it feels like Rey's journey is sort of tied up in everything else to some extent, but, I love the moment when Hux unholsters his blaster and then just puts it back
in. That's such a good moment. And that's such an un-George Lucas-y moment as well.
Yeah.
Because it's pure visual character storytelling it's another one of those jokes that has a purpose.
Yes.
Because it's funny, like you got a laugh in our cinema, but it's such a beautifully subtle character, like little moment about like how power is going to work from now on.
Yeah.
And what gambit he's making and why.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's a great moment.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So let's see. Are there any other character things you want to dwell on? I want to move on to humor because that'd be an interesting thing to talk about.
Yeah.
So Rey is maybe it's like.
Rey's maybe a way into something like Rey's a bigger topic.
Rey is a bigger topic, but at the same time, we have covered like the importance of her parentage and her arc and things. I do feel like, after the throne room scene, it's not that she doesn't have anything to do in the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Because she gets to shoot some things from the Millennium Falcon. Pick up a bunch of rocks. but she has kind of settled into her role at that point as I am Rey of the Resistance. Training is complete.
Return of the Jedi, Luke.
Yes, like, exactly.
If she had time to shop for a black polo neck, she would have done.
So she does get to kind of act as a bit of a Reus Ex Machina.
Hey! Well, if we're going to sort of wrap up on Rey, can I take a moment to say how much I really loved? I know I've mentioned this before. I really liked how they represented the Force. I genuinely like, as much as it might seem obvious to kind of create these like diptychs of like a picture of life, a picture of death. Like I found it really even though it's kind of funny that it's like after we all lived through midichlorians, we're finally going to understand the Force by like happy puffins and sad puffin broken eggs.
Somewhere between those two things is lifting things with your brain.
Lifting it rocks. I really like that sequence just as a piece of filmmaking, and that leads me into what we haven't talked about, which was I was momentarily worried about how they were visualizing the dark side and the temptation towards the dark side is that like the big hole in the island, because we all lived through Lost.
That's true.
And I didn't want there to be a wheel down there.
Yeah.
And like J.J. Abrams is not that far away, and I know he was only tangentially involved in Lost, but still. But when she goes down there, just as an example of what we, you know, I'm sure there's all kinds of opinions about this movie, but in terms of what we don't know if we're going to get what kind of filmmaker vision we're going to get with these films, because these are juggernauts. They're these huge, you know, like pop cultural leviathans, and we don't know how much kind of creative cinematic playfulness we're going to get. And that whole sequence of expressing her, like, trapped in herself / reliant on herself / not knowing where she comes from through the Hall of Mirrors sequence is really strange and expressive in ways that we don't necessarily deserve, right? And I don't say that in a way, but like we don't necessarily, again, sort of going into this is back to the analogy of Rian Johnson going to the pitch meeting and saying it's very important I show some teat milking, but I want to express this idea about Rey's like desire for parentage and connection and like what would tempt her in the dark side and how she sees herself through that, like the rhythm of like her clicking her fingers and like being in that long line of herself. I found that sequence really like visually striking and like great to see. And then obviously it has a relationship to like Luke in the cave and Force Ghosts and like then striking down Vader and everything.
Yeah. But, like the only thing that's as surreal as that in the original trilogy is Vader's mask containing Luke's face.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Though I suppose that is the mirror, right?
At the end
of both of those experiences, they both confront with themselves.
Yeah. I just think it's a really lovely moment, and that's a purely Rey moment that I wanted to give a shout out to.
Yeah. And, I mean, again, like, I did like the end with her as this, you know, and like her meeting Poe for the first time. Yeah. Actually, she gets the Han Solo line.
Yeah.
You know, I'm Poe. I know. I'm Rey. Yeah. Yeah. I know. Like, yeah.
I love you. I'm Poe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I love you, I'm Poe is the subtext to every scene he's in.
Yes. there's no one in this galaxy that does not want to sleep with Poe Dameron.
No, that's true.
Included.
Also,
sorry, Laura Dern included. Shout out to Poe Dameron's sexual tension with sexy older ladies. God damn.
Sorry, that was steam. Even my ears.
Just momentarily turned into a steam engine.
Man, just
we can wrap it right there.
We'll probably return to it when we talk about the themes of the film as well. Yeah. Like, because Rey as new Star Wars hero who comes from nowhere is its own topic. You mentioned humor. I want to talk about humor because it's a very funny film. It has a lot of good lines. There are elements like I think my favorite moments of humor and the ones that work the most, and this is happily most of them, are the ones that are grounded fully in your understanding of a character.
Yes.
So like Chewie trying
vegetarianism.
Chewie trying to eat a porg while a porg looks at him is just cool. Like you're just
it's
having
a nice character moment.
Yeah, like Chewie, you know, Chewie, this version of Chewie that wouldn't give a shit about this. Yeah. Like, you know, but
who in grief hasn't become a vegetarian, Chris?
Indeed. That was great. I actually like the porgs. There's an element of merch friendly design to them.
And there is something striking about like the Millennium Falcon gets a fabulous outing at the end of this movie, but it is also at this point a porg sanctuary.
Yeah.
And it is funny that like probably the most evocative thing in Star Wars is the Millennium Falcon, and we're going to just turn into like a into like Knowles, not Knowles, it's Fire Park. What's that bird? Not me.
Yeah.
Popular bird sanctuary north of England from our childhood.
There's, yes, and there's like, and there are, so there is that tier of humor, the stuff that's just built entirely out of like, and then there's what I would describe as, well, in other contexts, I would call it hanging a lampshade on things.
Yeah.
In this, I will call it putting a bin on BB-8. so there's, which is the one example of this, right? There are little moments that, slightly express a kind of knowing, love for Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like disguising BB-8 by putting a bin over him
and turning him into R2.
And him, no, him doing an impression of a mouse droid.
Yeah. Yeah. And he really wanted to get the,
because he goes like, in his own way.
Yeah.
And that includes lines like, there are some things you can't solve by getting an X-Wing or blowing something up.
Yeah.
And then 2 minutes later, permission to get into an X-Wing and blow something up. And then,
I mean, can we just for a moment, like, this is one of those moments that I loved in the moment. I could also I could also feel myself thinking that if I didn't like this film, this would be the thing I would say is like, what the fuck was that? But I think the first thing I said to you during the credits when we were able to talk was like, I can't believe they let BB-8 have a get away from her, you bitch.
Yeah. Like, BB-8 stealing an SST.
And I'm into it in that context. That shows how well this film was working for me last night, is that like, I was just glee at that point. But like, I can also imagine if I had hated this film, I would have been like, oh, for fuck's sake.
I think that sort of thing is helped by like, a sort of, like things like Rebels and things have done a lot to create an acceptable R2-D2 jetpack world we live in. Like, the reason that was so shit in the first place, actually, I think one of the reasons this is good is it's not R2 just demonstrating all these new capabilities, which is the weakness of this in the prequels. It's a new droid who has his own way of doing things. And
I will say that his First Order counterpoint is woefully undercharacterized. Well, I always wanted his backstory. I wanted four scenes of
bad
that
BB-8 for all of the kind of like, not hype, but like kind of like this character's in it. Was like, you know,
I am kidding. I really didn't want four scenes of his backstory, but, it just is funny that he's immediately like, who's that guy?
Yeah, exactly. Like bam, 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 bam. Yes. And like, there are lots of nice moments of, you know, just silliness that sort of plays with Star Wars. Like, Luke's sort of, can you feel the Force? And he's just waggling a fern over Rey's fingers.
Which, again, it's a very Yoda way to train someone as well.
Yes, it's very appropriate. Like,
Also, like, one of my favorite jokes, that's such an obvious, that shows that, like, the real, like, love and literacy for Star Wars, but it's also surprising that the joke hasn't happened before, is that moment right at the end where 3PO is giving the odds and of the odds of them finding an escape, and Poe tells him to shut up, and then he does the 2-1.
Yeah.
Like that, and again, that landed really well in our cinema.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, there's lots of little moments like that I did like. I was trying to think, one of them just completely escaped me.
Was it a Hux moment? There was a lot of Hux humor.
There's a lot of Hux humor. Well, so there is, and there is stuff that's maybe silly in a way that Star Wars hasn't always done before, like the prank phone call to Hux, which is very human. It reminded
me. You took first?
It's very similar to the You Took First. Yeah. I took first from Force Awakens. It reminded me a lot of, and if any of my friends who I do Star Wars role playing with have heard this, it felt a lot like almost Star Wars improv in a way. Like, you know what I mean? There's a sort of like, there's a loose quality to it that's kind of unlike the kind of tightly scripted kind of Kirshner-y.
Which I think, I mean, maybe this is being a bit arsy, but there's something metatextual, or like there's something about the Empire reading off the script while, not the Empire, sorry, the First Order reading off the script while, the Resistance improv is how they work.
Yes.
Yeah, strategically, well, and militarily.
As well.
You know, so there's something about, like, Chris, you mentioned to me that apparently, like, humor Hux has been not well received. I actually didn't really get, I really like Donald Gleason, but I didn't love Hux in The Force Awakens. I felt he was a bit too broad. I was just like, I'm just a bad guy.
I'm just a dickhead.
And whereas I liked his, I mean, one, as we've said, that moment with the gun is really nice. And I think broadly, he's just, it's slightly.
He gets some great lines in this as well. Like, do you think you got him at the end?
Yes.
Like,
oh, that was a great line. Yeah.
Like his sort of, like, if his sort of sparky hatred for Kylo Ren does not fuel, is not the spark that fuels 1,000 tumblers.
Yeah.
Then
the spark.
Then
this movie has failed.
Indeed.
But no, I liked the fact that it was revealing some of the kind of like Hannah Arendt's famous book, The Pomposity of Evil. But like, yes, you know, like how like puncturing the pomposity of the First Order. Pomposity.
Yes. Like, and there was sort of, yeah, God, I've completely blanked on what the other good moments of surprising Star Wars light piss taking.
I mean, that's a lot of Luke's characterization in this film. Like, which again has a thematic point, like being able to take the piss out of it. Of like,
yeah, or like Yoda saying like, page turners, they were not. Like,
again, one of those things that if this has been a bad movie, I would have been like, oh, Yoda's dialogue, but it worked for me.
Yes. So actually, I think, minor note on some of the writing. I think there was a modernity to some of the phrasing.
Yeah.
That, was, struck a little bit strangely for me.
There's some of that in the, rewatching the original trilogy recently. There are moments of that as well. Like, I'm trying to think of, there's a really obvious example of like a line that just sounds very like 70s American, but it'll come.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So the only thing, I'll give you an example, right? I love the bit between Leia and, Holdo, Laura Dern.
Yeah.
Where they both start saying, may the force be with you at the same time.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, we've done so many times. Do you want to finish? And then she says the rest of it.
Yeah.
Right. Where Holdo says the rest of it. That's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a strange moment on the bridge, which has a bit of a first drafty feel to it.
Yeah.
Where Holdo sort of looks out at the rebel ships fleeing to the planet and says, Godspeed.
Yes.
And I hit that exact. So recently,
Han says go to hell a couple of times in the original trilogy, and it's like hell.
Yes.
Where's hell? Like,
yeah. There's a.
I'll see you in hell. Or something like
I
that.
I think there's a hell reference in this as well.
Yeah.
Actually, but that. So I remember this, and this is a bit of an aside. But in like I wrapped up my year spanning Star Wars role playing campaign recently, and I was doing NPC, and I said something like. You know, just off the cuff, because it's improvised, like, you know, what in God's name? Like that kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sort of Imperial officer, frustrated, you know, what in God's name are you talking about kind of thing. And I corrected myself.
Yeah.
And I went, and then I just changed the line, because it was like, because, you know, C-3PO can say maker.
Yeah.
And everyone else has the force.
Yeah.
But God has not been established as a phrase. So that rang a little bit strangely to me, like that line.
Yeah.
I don't, that's a completely off topic of humor, but like that line, I was like, ooh, you know what I mean? There's a tiny little inch of too much real, which is going to be the reason the casino zone doesn't
work. And I feel that maybe that's the segue we can do now, because both in like clunky dialogue and being too anchored in like contemporary stuff. Do you want to talk about the casino land?
I do, because the other reason I want to talk about it is to end on humor as well.
Yeah.
Where I think the humor doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I feel this way about every Star Wars film.
Yeah.
Is when it is purely slapstick for its own sake.
Yeah.
And this film doesn't have as much of it as the prequels, which are overloaded with it. And it actually, it's not a problem that the original trilogy had until the special editions.
Yeah.
Thanks, George. The bit in the casino zone where
the Sonic,
whatever it's called.
The Ice Cap Zone at the end,
Ice Cap Zone.
It's much better.
The Sonic, the casino zone for Sonic the Hedgehog that is in this film. When BB-8 is mistaken
for
a slot machine by a tiny
Mr. Moneybags
alien with a monocle, everything about that is busted to me, even though it does set up a sequence later on where BB-8 fires coins at people like a machine gun.
Again, in the Master's house will not be taken down by the Master's tools. anti-capitalist dreamboat BB-8 destroying the police state for the power of throwing money at them.
Yes.
I'm very into that, but we're not into how it worked.
No, and the reason for it is partly because, obviously, BB-8 is as a well-liked character and is in that moment, but it doesn't say anything about BB-8. Yeah. Really, like, I've been mistaken for a slot machine by a drunk Mr. Moneybags mini alien. It's not, you know, fun in that way. And also it's very like, so that entire, the conception of that casino planet, in principle is fine. Like, I like the idea of going somewhere like a kind of more corrupt Bespin, you know, that kind of thing. However, it is remarkably on the nose.
Yeah.
And far too close to real life. It's not weird enough.
It's
not weird enough.
No, it's not. And it both. So I think it's smart at that. Well, it would have been a choice either way, but at this point in the movie, like in the beginning, it was so unlike other Star Wars movies, but it was quite close. It seemed at the first it's BSG. It's like literally the first couple of episodes of BSG of like having to keep, like not being able to keep jumping. And most of our action is on ship, like with the exception of the Luke and Rey stuff, which is a space we've physically seen before, even if only briefly at the end of The Force Awakens. This is a Star Wars movie that is mostly some wars happening in the stars, which would have been a choice and not necessarily a bad one to stick with it, but I was quite amazed, like, God, we haven't been on a planet at this point. I think it's a good idea to have the little, to have the Finn-Rose off-ship adventure, because, and as we keep gesturing towards, we want to get to this, I love the broader theme of this movie being about, coming to consciousness, like, sorry to keeping Marxist, but like,
The
idea that this is about a kind
the
of-
The Force
like,
is woke now.
Read it, oh, God, the Force awokens. Yeah. But like, the idea of the real importance being like, the class consciousness of the working class, but it's good, like, the stuff with the children really worked for me, and I like that happens by them going off planet. I also think that even if the execution isn't always great, but like the character of DJ as a kind of moral in between and the idea and gesturing towards weapon sales and all that stuff really works for me. The problem is that it just seems like a very first draft way of doing it. The idea that like, we've talked about this, there's nothing wrong with the idea of them going to look for like a weapons dealer and like that being their way.
Yeah. Way of doing the sequence? There is a lot of problems with this part of the film, even though it's, you're right, its point is correct, and I like Rose and I like Finn.
Yeah.
I like the themes. I would say that the casino itself, from its conception, there's two ways of, so Star Wars, yes, it's weird looking aliens in sort of recognizable sort of human places, like bars.
With a slightly more like syncopated cantina music kind of.
Backwards
like,
jazz and dudes in suits.
Yeah.
You know, Mos Eisley Cantina and Jabba's Palace and that kind of thing.
But it's so
they
modern.
Haven't successfully, you know, we've seen that in the context of Maz Kanata's castle is successful, I think. So they've done it right consistently when it comes to like the outer rim, the kind of the grungier places of the world. The prequels, I'd hate their conception of what high society, a kind of Star Wars looks like, because it is fundamentally just like, I'm an alien, but my face tentacles look like a mustache, look like a posh man mustache. Yeah. And it's too, like, it's not weird enough while also trying to be weird.
Yeah.
And it's, when it's enabled by CGI, you don't have the kind of the joy of simply the craft of puppeteering and costume making and those kinds of things. And like, I would say that like that casino.
It operates through really modern logic.
Yeah, like
even like the little rakes for the chips. And like, of course, like I'm sure people are always going to gamble. We've got lots of gamblers and chess.
Why isn't it 3D space chess?
Why does it look so much like Monaco or Atlantic City or Vegas? Like
why are slot machines real?
And like the idea like old women do slot machines.
It's like the rest of the film is so interested in being in kind of like taking apart the assumptions of Star Wars and this thing weirdly like. It's a moment when it doesn't go full Dax's Diner, but honest to God, it is almost as weird as there being a 50s American diner in Coruscant.
Yeah,
like,
I was enjoying the sequence, but like, it's definitely the first moment I was really worried in the film.
Yes, and it's the moment I suspect it's going to be a lot quicker when you watch it again, because it's...
Yeah, like, it's, yeah.
So, and also, so, I want to kind of, maybe this is how we get onto the plot stuff, but like, cause I don't want to do on it too much because it's such a long film. There's so much else going on that it sort of survives it. But I think that entire sequence, including DJ's character, we didn't really talk, we haven't really talked about Benicio del Toro yet. When I came out of the film, I thought he wasn't necessary. And the more I think about it, like, I like that you get this kind of like, people sell to both sides. You know,
I like that at first he's kind of morally right and doing something that like these films really need, which is to kind of look at like who is like, again, sorry to like just be like, this is a film about like how capitalism is bad, but like to say like who's making the money and why is a really like nice intervention. And the idea of like the selling X-Wings as well as selling TIE Fighters, I really like. And I also buy and go with the kind of the resolution of that, which is like, there's a way to be, there's a kind of through line of being critical, but also being like resistant to like oppressive power. And he doesn't care. Like he's correctly critiquing things, but is also is so far out of it that like he doesn't believe there's a right at this point at all. And so can just be a turncoat. I think that all works.
Yeah. So I think a couple of the problems with this stem partly from the fact that, because you mentioned when we were talking about it earlier, that a lot of the dialogue in that sequence is also quite clunky.
It's really,
because they have to keep reminding the viewer why they're there.
And I get that I get that this happens in all kinds of films, but especially in genre films. I know that it has a young audience and you want to kind of remind and give exposition, but it's particularly, there's a couple of moments, and this is a thing that like annoys a lot of people I know, but Rose and Finn do a lot of arriving somewhere than having the conversation they would have had in the car on the way there. Like they walk in there and say like, do a lot of like, well, now we're here, we should look for the guy with the red thing on the doodad. And like when they're in the cell, they're like, now that we haven't found the red guy with the doodad, how will we find the code breaker? We need to like do the the shield. Like it's considering the whole look of the place is so first drafty that the dialogue also sounds like, oh, we'll do another run on this.
And I think one of the things that's a challenge for it, that one of the reasons causes that problem, is the plan is too complicated. Like we need to find a code breaker who can get us through the shield of the Star Destroyer so that we can disable the device that allows them to track them through hyperspace. We can talk about the logic of that whole chase.
Yeah, I think we should.
But to unpick it, because a lot of the film's logical problems stem from there, and they're not that important, because as we've said, we kind of enter this kind of magical realist Star Wars place now, where the characters and the themes are more important. But, so, if I were to do the thing I did for The Force Awakens and kind of like figure out like, just as almost an intellectual exercise, like how do you make this more elegant? I think the way you make it more elegant is, like, I think the FaceTime with Maz as she jetpacks around fighting people scene isn't necessary.
No, it's really not necessary.
I think you need a character, someone on the ship, say, you know, introduce the idea that in order to get onto a First Order ship, you probably need, you know, maybe even Finn could know this.
Yeah.
Like, you need one of the arms dealers that they work with.
Yeah.
So their mission to, you know, certain ships have permission to land, something like that.
Yeah.
So you need, because even a ship that size is constantly receiving,
yeah,
you know, it's like a floating, vessel, you know, like,
I can see the argument that might be like, not now, like, I don't know, like, yeah, no salesman right now, but like still, yeah, it does make more sense.
We need a ship with access. We need a ship with access.
And the idea that an arms dealer would have access.
Yeah. And so like, and then someone has the idea, well, what if we go up from one of the arms dealers? So the reason they're on the planet is simply to find a ship with access to the First Order. So they go there with the knowledge that they're going somewhere where there are lots of First Order sympathizers.
Yeah.
So maybe that changes Finn's reaction to it a little bit.
Yeah.
But he could have that kind of like, wow, this place is actually amazing.
Yeah.
And she says, well, and then Rose can say, look what's supporting it. And then they have all the same themes. And then I thought a really nice twist I was sort of expecting, but didn't happen, was, you know, and then it follows that they get arrested. We don't have to bother with the man with the red lapel, who we don't know.
Who I later learned is Justin Theroux and not Louis Theroux, which would have been better.
Okay, yes, indeed.
Because Joe Cornish is in the movie, apparently. So we don't have Louis Theroux as well.
You know, we have all that. And then, so maybe this doesn't quite, but like, I really like, you know, so, and then, DJ lies to them on the ship, you know, shows them on the ship and shows them the lie of the arms dealer sell to both sides.
Yeah.
I thought the twist was going to be that it was his ship.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like when he sells them out, I thought it was going to be like, well, it's my, you know, I sold you to them.
Yeah.
And it just took your lie to get you there.
Yeah.
Like, that I thought would have been neat, but I think giving them a more straightforward reason to go, maybe it's not 100% right, but I think you would get away from that clunkiness of like, so the clunkiness of them having to leave the fleet to find a codebreaker.
Yeah.
Like, the first step would be, well, we'll ask around.
Yeah, just, yeah, have a chat.
Like, yeah. So because the plan is too complicated, and I say that specifically in reference to traditional Star Wars, which has always kept things simple.
Yeah.
Like, the hyperdrive done broke.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. That's all you need to know. Rather than this convoluted thing that makes an already clunky sequence not work as well. Also, and maybe this is, like, when I first walked out of the film, I was sort of trying to unpick some of the logical holes in it.
Because
they do bother me.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
I don't want to be a pedant. And feel like
you need to feel like the film is real. Like,
yes. And I think there's every time a film has plot holes in, no matter how much it's about other things, they drain the potential for the film to have other character moments because nothing means anything after a certain point. So obviously the notion that spaceships can chase each other for 16 hours and, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, the logic of that, the whole setup at the time, you know, it's the Death Star will be in firing range in 5 minutes problem stretched out over 16 hours.
Yeah,
for the whole film. And that's fine in that Star Wars has always had a very strange relationship with time. Like, The Empire Strikes Back famously is like 18 hours in the life of Han and Leia while Luke goes away for a week in the same amount of time.
Yeah.
This is Leia goes, Rey goes to Luke for a week.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, 16 hours pass for everybody else. And you can do the gymnastics to
figure
out.
And we did say that we want to watch it again and sort of try and figure out how the Ben, Rey, FaceTime chats, like, fit in with the continuity.
So those are sort of things. And I think to a certain extent with just the logic of, like, why the First Order doesn't have any ships that are faster.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's something you ultimately have to go with, I think. And Star Wars, you know, it would certainly not be the first time Star Wars has had something you just have to go with.
Yeah.
I think both The Force Awakens and this have things which are like, you know, it's like the sequence in The Force Awakens where they're on Takodana, after Matt Samas' castle, and they see the laser being fired from Starkiller Base to a different planet in the galaxy, which is, it makes no sense.
Like,
there's
like,
no
like,
way
like,
of explaining
the
it.
The sun has just been destroyed. How is, like, it's
it makes no sense. It's like seeing, and in real time as well, like, light works a certain way in space.
Yeah.
Like, it'd have to have happened, like, 80 million years ago. And be the brightest thing in the universe.
Yeah.
Like, it makes no sense. And this has a similar aspect to that. That's, you know, ultimately you just go with it because it's how the plot hangs together. The thing that I think, and so all this stuff is sort of filtered away in my brain, and it's not as glaring because of the film's many strengths, which we've already talked about. The thing that has stuck with me is Finn and Rose's mission is ultimately completely unimportant and only serves to put them in danger and ultimately to get quite a lot of the rebels killed because DJ is the one that gives away their escape plan to the First Order.
Yeah,
it's even not really established how DJ knows about it, apart from the fact that he must have overheard it off screen at some point.
Well, I mean, no, they literally say it in one of those clunky exposition things in the prison cell.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, their line is actually like, but if we don't have a codebreaker that's going to stop the shield, how will they get away from the blah-blah-blah? Oh, no, sorry, you mean the planet.
I meant him knowing about Holdo's secret plan, right?
Yeah.
Like that. You know,
how do they know that? I'm sure it's a start. I'm sure there's something, but
I don't think he's ever told about the cloaked ships, the cloaked shuttles.
Would, yeah.
But yes, so it serves no purpose in that regard. That's okay in terms that it can be a folly. It could be another Poe mistake.
War is hell.
Yeah, yeah. Poe makes mistakes, right?
Yeah.
Like, Poe gets people killed doing silly things sometimes. However, the problem is that Poe goes to Laura Dern.
Yeah,
goes to Holdo and says, I need to know what the plan is. Please tell me the plan.
Yeah.
And he does this actually after he's already sent Finn away, but like he does it before as well.
Yeah.
Like, okay, how are we going to get out of this? And he refuses to accept her inaction.
Yeah.
And at that point, we later find she does have a plan.
Yeah.
And it's to get people to the shuttles and et cetera. And at this, I don't buy why she doesn't explain it to him at all. Like, I can't, that's the thing that I can't think my way around. Like, and it does hurt the film a little bit.
And you suggested a very like elegant and like this is kind of where I thought it was going when they were like, how are they tracking us? That whole thing, like an elegant way around it is like the fear that there's someone on the brig that is like compromised.
Yes. So they have to keep the plan secret.
Yeah.
That would be something. I also think a potential here is for her to explain the plan
and
for Poe to simply disagree with it.
Yeah,
like that would have worked. Like, to have it be like, I'm not going to accept, we go and hide on that planet and hope other people come and save us.
Yeah.
Because that is her plan, is get to the planet, use the transmitter, call in reinforcements.
Except for the fact that his broader arc, and maybe this would work, but like, yeah, his broader arc is shifting away from like flying X-Wing into a thing, into literally like his show of leadership at the end is to help people run away.
Yes.
And so like, so it would either work or not work based on, because like, so in the film as it stands, that part of his character is initiated by his like respect for her plan, so you know he like gets what she was trying to do, and so it's partially like triggered by that idea that there are other ways to fight this war, and like and you could still pull off something similar by him like just impulsively hating the plan.
Yes, and I think in the moment he's afraid and angry and everything else, and so he hates it, and Finn hates it, and they want to do the dramatic. Infiltrate the thing and do the thing. Yeah. So they come up with this plan to, in my headcanon version of this, you know, find someone with access.
Go to Sarkar from Thor Ragnarok. Meet Jeff Goldblum.
That was a really good point, right? The alien world that Jeff Goldblum rules in Thor Ragnarok is a more convincing Star Wars hedonistic casino zone than the one in Star Wars.
Yeah. It's more alien. It's weirder. It's, yeah.
Yeah, it's far more fun.
Yeah, like, it's more fun. It has a clear aesthetic,
Yeah, so that I think is just one of those things that, like, it's just a hole, really. Like, it's just a hole in the film. Like,
do you want to do some hyperdrive problems?
Well, okay, so yes. And then I do find, like, hopefully this is not too tiresome, but, like, it's interesting because I think you have to face some of the elephants in the room.
Absolutely,
when you make plot decisions.
Yeah.
So, Laura Holdo turning the Radis around
and
hyperspace ramming Snoke's flagship is an astonishing bit of
presentation. It's beautiful. Yeah, the cutting out of sound. I'm kind of glad we were in a cinema, like we were in a midnight showing where no one like shouted something dumb.
But everyone's just like flabbergasted.
Yeah,
about,
like it was a beautiful moment. But
so there's a thing. There's an elephant in the room here. It's a good. It's an interesting character moment. It's an act of sacrifice. But unfortunately, as soon as Star Wars has opened the jar marked hyperspace ramming techniques work.
And these kind of ships can be flown by one person.
It causes quite a lot of damage to every other space battle sequence in Star Wars, including in this film, because they let both the medical frigate and the other support ship get destroyed and their captains stay behind and die as they run out of fuel.
Yeah.
Whereas both of them should have turned them around and hyperspace rammed the fleet. Like, again, it's just one of those things you can't explain. It's just like, we wanted the sacrifice moment and then we want, like, and this whole section of the film is where the logic is the weakest, I think, for the whole thing. And also it's like, you know, the oldest hoary old boring Star Wars argument is like, why didn't they just hyperspace ram the Death Star? Why didn't they just hyperspace ram the other Death Star?
Yeah.
Why didn't they just hyperspace ram Starkiller Base with something big enough?
Yeah.
Why isn't every Star Destroyer in the Imperial Navy taken up by one X-Wing with one brave droid in it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, droids can do whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, just send droid piloted hyperdrives into space. Like,
you had a nice solution I liked.
So this is headcanon therapy here. It's like how to make this work because it's a gorgeous sequence that,
it thematically works in the sense that like, and we've been talking about people's relationships with legend and the fact that she is someone with like military renown that they're surprised to see what she actually looks like because they don't know who she is.
Yeah, which is great.
And then she pulls off this like astonishing military sacrifice, but like very like it's both spectacle, but like unflashy on her part. So it's keeping with this kind of idea of like who is a hero and
I think a more elegant version of this in terms of like causing problems for the films would have simply been she turns around and rams them.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, stays on with the crew.
Yeah, stays on with the crew and it's a spectacle of a much smaller capital ship fighting a doomed last stand against this gigantic Star Destroyer and dying, but doing enough damage to, you know, create the distraction in the hangar that allows Finn and Rose to escape, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The only way I was thinking about this, I had a shower thought this morning about it. And I think to patch that gap in that it creates in the fiction, I think the way to do it is to say that, you know, it's been long established in all of Star Wars fiction from the very first film that hyperdrive calculations take a little time to kind of calculate a jump route that doesn't take you through another object.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it depends how deep into the EU you want to get, but like hyperspace travel is usually depicted as like point to point, like from one location, you can jump to this other location, and, you know, it takes a while to do. It's fuzzy. It's always been fuzzy, but like, you can establish that hyperspace travel is not like you can go from anywhere to anywhere.
Yeah.
It's like there are specific points of travel that you have to kind of line up with.
Yeah.
And all I think it needs is an acknowledgement that the first thing every capital ship commander learns in Star Wars is, in a battle, always position yourself in like hyperspace blind spots.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about space. It's fucking massive. Yeah. You can hide a 16 kilometer spaceship, presumably in the gap between stars. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you can imagine, and you can imagine that this is something that's just always been quietly happening.
Yeah.
That, you know, space battle commanders don't make mistakes. And also, you know, it wouldn't be possible in a shorter range conflict with lots of capital ships because you'd destroy loads of your own ships.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But they're always positioning themselves so that this isn't possible.
Yeah.
Basically, like, you can jump to hyperspace. But not through something, because everyone is positioning themselves in the blind spots where this can't happen.
This sort of like space ley lines that you've traveled on.
Yeah. And like, just don't be in the way, basically, because it's too much of a risk. And obviously, there's going to be lots of scenarios where you wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Like sacrifice one of your ships. But, and then that plot beat in this film becomes more about the arrogance of the First Order, who have chased, Holdo's flagship to a point where they've made themselves vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like, in their haste to track down, to chase her.
Yeah.
They have allowed themselves to be drawn into a position where she has a hyperspace line.
Yeah.
That leads through the First Order fleet. Yeah. And she takes it.
Yeah.
And that would, you don't even need to change any dialogue there if you understand it in that way.
Yeah.
Because it means that that little in dialogue that takes place between the First Order officers.
Yeah.
Where one of them says, she's running, you know, she's jumping to hyperspace.
Yeah.
And then you have that moment on that look on the commander's face as he realizes, like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like, all that needs to be is I've made a huge mistake. Like, you know what I mean? Is he, you know, looks at his own position and it's like, yes, it is like, you know, this is when he realized he'd fucked up.
Yeah.
And he's put himself like
Ron Howard, director of Solo,
she sees the window and she takes it.
Yeah.
And I think that makes that moment much more gratifying without losing the spectacle of it, because it becomes a kind of like one in a million opportunity rather than
which is a very Star Wars-y moment. It's like when a one in a million shot lines up and you take it.
So yeah, I think it's in, these problems are interesting because, and a lot of them unfortunately seem to orbit the Raddus and decisions that get made on the Raddus, because there's so much more to this film and I've already spent 20 minutes talking about it. But I think it is important because I think if you walk out of a film going like, that was great, but why?
We both walked out with kind of like, huh, about things like that. Yeah. And I haven't like read a lot of the reaction, but I wonder like if that's some of the things that people are just like, what about?
Yeah. Like, you know, because otherwise I think the films can be guilty of constructing a gorgeous image, but not thinking about its consequences for the integrity of the story.
And don't get me wrong, I'm glad to have filmmakers who are interested in constructing a gorgeous image after like George, what's cinematography Lucas? Like, I'm glad to have, like, George Lucas has a visual sense that has nothing to do with cinema.
Yes, that's
true. He has an interest in building worlds, which I really appreciate, but he doesn't have a visual sense that's to do with like movie rhythm, movie affect, like what you can do with visual images.
Yes.
The composition of a scene, like he's not interested in that stuff. And it's really nice to have filmmakers that are.
Yes. However, Star Wars has this other life as a universe that is occupied by people that you can believe, that you can tell lots of different types of story in.
Absolutely.
And now that is now paying off in the cinematic universe with the Star Wars stories and so on, and the integrity of those stories and the integrity of that universe that can have other stories told in it relies on certain kinds of logic.
You need to all agree on certain things, like what works and what are the laws of this universe? Like,
because if any ship can hyperspace jump into any other ship at any time.
Yeah.
Then
why have we done half the things?
Yes, exactly.
Like,
you know, like if Poe Dameron, like, I mean, literally it applies to this film so much, right? Like, they sacrifice like half the fleet doing something that one ship could have done.
Yeah.
So, you know, it needs that little bit of logic just so that.
To give things physical
other
shape
character
and
things have meaning. Because that's the thing. Like, I don't think you need to worry about this stuff in order to, make sure that your, like, you know, big encyclopedia of Star Wars stats doesn't get disrupted. I think it needs that sense of logic simply to preserve the meaning of character.
Yeah, emotional stakes, like choices, decisions. Yeah, logic. Yeah.
I think that what moment works better as Laura Dern has led them into a one in a million trap.
Yeah.
That allows her to do this spectacular thing.
Yeah.
Rather than, Laura Dern is the first person to figure
I've
out
never
that this
thought
works.
Of this. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, that's enough on that, I think. So I think we should talk about the future of Star Wars now. And I think we should talk about that in terms of, yeah, well, we've tested it throughout this thing, but this movie has changed what Star Wars is potentially about.
Yeah.
And it has two final scenes in a way. Yeah. It has the rebellion is now small enough, and it's the rebellion again.
Yeah.
And it's now small enough that it fits on the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah.
We have the family shot, the panning out of them all together, that final shot.
Porgon R2.
Yeah, there's a Porgon R2, Rey and Carrie.
The last of our princess. Yeah.
Yeah, God. You know, they are together.
Yeah.
But then for the first time ever in a Star Wars film, the last scene, the pan out, the directed by cut is back with those kids in Casino World.
Yeah.
And they are the important ones now. And a little boy is hearing the story of Luke Skywalker.
I'm getting chills right now.
Yeah. And he goes outside, pulls a broom into his hand with the Force.
Looks into the stars.
Shows that he's wearing Rose's rebellion ring and looks at the stars as a ship jumps to hyperspace, which is in some ways, it's so unusual that I think initially, I think it's possible to be a bit uncertain about how to take that at first. So, you know, obviously in the kids, in the kind of the urchins of Star Wars, there are echoes of the Phantom Menace. Yep. I think that's very hard to get around.
I mean, we both wondered if it was like a pod track when we saw the
pod racing track. Yeah. That would have been a really brave decision, actually, like rehabilitate pod racing. But anyway, and there is also something of the, I think unfortunately moments like this have slight shades of, there are a lot of companies when they get the opportunity to plaster Star Wars all over their advertising, take the approach of little kid playing Star Wars in the back garden and then it comes to life.
Yeah.
Like there's literally one of those adverts before the film. So for me, there's like, oh, it's uncomfortably close, but then the kind of thing. The important thing here is that, I think you said it better, much better, and so I'll let you say it, but like, it's that starting with Rey coming from nowhere and the destruction of what's happened before, it's the notion that Star Wars is no longer one faction versus another faction, but a kind of ideal up against
ideological.
It's strange. Star Wars has never existed in that place before where you can't say what faction that child belongs to.
Yeah. And obviously, like, he's physically wearing the things, but like, I think what's interesting to me, like, someone, I've forgotten the name of the journalist, but there was a piece in The Guardian, like, a week ago or 2 weeks ago or something about, like, someone saying they didn't want Rey to be in, a Skywalker because of the kind of the fixation on genealogy. And he was putting it through the lens of elite families, the idea of like inherited wealth and like princesses and like, but it's bigger than that. And don't get me wrong. Family is really important. Family is a really important emotional through line of so many of the Star Wars. Like we like love in Star Wars, but, there is, again, not to just get on my like political soapbox, but, to imagine other ways of living, you have to imagine other ways of connecting to people. It's a very kind of capitalist logic that like the only people that matter ethically are the people you kind of own, that you exist in these kind of family structures with. Like liberty, well, sorry, I'm just going to call for a revolution, but like models of like freedom are based on familial forms of like coalition and love, to use the language of this film, you know, thanks Rose. And the idea that like one, that power isn't just inherited is important, and that's what we're getting with Rey. It's not just midichlorians in the bloodstream or whatever. Which, you know, this in the Guardian thing he was reading, it was kind of like a money thing, but like regardless of whether it's to do with inherited wealth or whatever, it's not just like inherited power. But part of it is also this idea of like where does revolution come from if not from individual people kind of coming together, and like that the image of getting like having your cake and eating it, having both the biological and, well, actually I suppose there isn't any biological family in that last shot, but like both gesturing towards the biological family and the kind of created family of like you know, of like Finn and Rey's like created family and like whatever. Like you've got all of that on the Falcon, and you've also got this kind of like hope for people coming together, and they've got it in a position right now where they could go kind of where do they go with what's the rebellion going to look like in the next film is an interesting question.
Yes.
Like, is this all going to be like lighting this like fire across the galaxy? Like, are they going to be more powerful? Are they going to have more ships? Are they going to, like, is it going to be, I think like the way they resolve the, DJ is to say that like, no, you do have to pin your flag. You have to pin your flag, pin your colors, do something to something. Like there is such a thing as good and like protecting life.
Yeah.
But like, how are these allegiances going to work is like an interesting question.
Yes.
Especially because we don't really know what the antagonist is. Like we don't know what Kylo Ren's first order is now. Mm. So it's, boy, am I glad that Colin Trevorrow. That him. That guy is not directing this. Cause I think it's, I mean, I wouldn't know like what the best way to go for the next episode is. And I'm sure glad he's not going to,
Yeah. I think so. Like back at like Star Wars Celebration this year, I kind of sat down and tried to figure out like if I had to like figure out what Star Wars was about, like how would I distill it to like a phrase? And the phrase I got down to was, family against the odds.
Yeah.
And like that I think is the key. It's not just family. Yeah. It's like unlikely family. Yeah. Up against sometimes an impossible thing.
Sometimes your real uncle is a Wookiee.
Sometimes your real uncle is a Wookiee. Sometimes your Falcon's full of porgs. Like, but like, it's always against the odds is very important. Yeah. Like, it's crucial that one of the big mistakes of the prequels is matched forces aren't Star Wars.
Yeah. Which is funny considering balance is so important, but yeah.
Yes. Like, yes, it is, but balance is almost an ideal that's never reached, right?
Yeah.
And I'm challenging that a little bit because there's this idea that I like this challenging idea that there's more to that family than you, as you say, the unit, the core unit that forms, that it's okay for people outside of that kind of core cast to have power and have important things to do. Like this kid at the end having the Force.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere.
Like
Rose.
Yeah.
Who all have big roles to play despite kind of coming from nowhere, not quote unquote earning it in the kind of traditional lore kind of way. I think that's an idea. I still think that kind of holds together as the idea that this ultimately forms a kind of family.
Yeah.
A rebel alliance, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's, as you say, it is a different way of conceiving kind of power and just, you know, and how people relate to one another and you know, in the context of a film full of puffins, a space film with a lot of puffins in it. Yeah. I'm trying to think.
Get me wrong. I don't believe that, that Disney Corporation's probably record breaking huge film is going to be the thing that causes global communism tomorrow. I'm just saying that like it's a different model and I like that.
Yeah.
I also want to say that I also think family is super important. There's a reason we're doing this as brother and sister.
Yes, indeed. But yes, there's definitely a kind of interesting question about how the next film works. Like I said this earlier, but I think they may have even said there'll be a time jump between episode 8 and episode 9. I suspect this may be a little bit like the original trilogy or even a little bit like, the prequels. So, Force Awakens into The Last Jedi is unique among Star Wars films because there's very little time between them. Mm-hmm. Apart from Rogue One and A New Hope, but obviously that was kind of bolted on. Mm-hmm. In terms of main episodes, this is the first time it's ever like straight into the next one rather than like X amount of time passes, now join us on Hoth, or X amount of time passes, we're now ready to rescue Han Solo. I think this is going to be X amount of time passes and now we will see the end of whatever war is about to start, is my guess. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, it'd be very interesting, you know what I mean? Otherwise, because this ends up feeling like the start of a new trilogy with the ending of this one. It's a bit of a woolly point, but I'm very tired and I've been talking for a long time. You know what I mean, though? But like, I wonder if we'll see like a similar jump to the one that takes place between Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, where you go from seeing the start of the Clone Wars and then the end of the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
And this fertile territory is left behind in the middle for other stories to ultimately be told over time. I don't know. I think a time jump is the most elegant way to handle Carrie Fisher passing.
I was going to say.
She's gone off somewhere else, right? Yeah. Like, you know, she's...
Yeah. I mean, or she could have died, but like, I think if you can't, I mean, I would be surprised if they pulled off or handled delicately, doing like she's literally just died without you seeing it in the context where you've seen Han's death and you've seen Luke's end. Like,
yes, I think that's tricky.
It would make more sense for her, like, for it to be referenced, like, respectfully, but like it to have happened a while ago rather than just like, yeah.
Yeah, rather than open with Luke's Force ghost at Leia's funeral.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I'm barely joking, but that's the thing that could have really happened. Like, but yeah, I think there's it's interesting. I think it's going to be really interesting how angry this sort of democratization of Star Wars power.
Yeah.
Of basically democratization of access to revolutionary power in Star Wars. This is not the thesis I thought I'd be writing today.
Also love.
And also love.
Not to get all queer theory, but also like,
yeah.
Like, forms of like forms of love and connection.
Rebellion is rebellion is rebellion is rebellion. Yeah. But it'd be interesting to see how angry it makes people because, and this is maybe not to end on too much internet politics, but the risible Rey Mary Sue argument is based on the fact that she has unearned power.
Yeah.
And this film is very proud about saying, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole notion of a Mary Sue has been, you know, has, you know, from its origins in fan fiction, has been twisted into, a sort of sexist pejorative, basically. Like, it probably already was to some extent, but I don't think it was always used in that context.
Yeah.
You know, author self-insertion is a sort of its own concept.
Yeah.
That was it's a concept, right? You know, it has conceptual meaning. And that has been twisted and turned into this phrase. That will no doubt not go away now, because of the decisions this film makes. But I love, one of the things I do like about that ending is like, it is a sort of little like, fuck you.
There are lots of others.
Here's your galaxy full of heroes and protagonists waiting to.
Yeah. Waiting to have something to believe in.
Yeah. Waiting to emerge as well. I don't.
It's almost like they need a new hope.
Indeed. 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 I think, I think there is something a little bit, like the conception of the entire casino zone.
Yeah.
The specific image of a little boy sweeping a broom and then holding it up like a lightsaber and pointing it at the stars.
You kind of want, like, I do like it, but I agree that, like, you can kind of, it's easy to pick apart and be like, so why in a world of, like, in a world of first order ironing robots, like, we still need brooms though.
First order ironing robots are pure space balls in a way that,
why do we not, not to lean into your side projects, but like, that's a job for a Roomba, surely.
It is, yes. there's, well, also like, I think, so again, it's the sort of like, make it weirder kind of impulse that I have, I think, with Star Wars, which is like, this could have been a little alien kid holding up a Hydra's banner.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I'm trying to think if it would have, like, I'm trying to, like, deal with my own, like, evocative relationship to a human child, but you're right, yeah.
Yeah, like, you
know. That was a weird sentence.
Well.
I enjoy a human child.
Well, you do, you know, there's certainly, we're getting deep into the reads here, so I don't want to, you know, stick on this point too long, but like, there's certainly, you know, Star Wars, even as it gets braver and starts to challenge itself, it's still this giant magic kind of cinematic mess of the best thing ever with holes in it. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And we are here because when we were human children, this was what imagination looked like.
Yes.
And like, as much as that has been, as you say, co-opted by toy adverts, there is that in that scene.
Yeah. And as the center of pop culture, it's important when it tries new things. Equally, it's never going to be perfect about it.
Yeah.
It's always going to be, full of holes as science fiction, which includes very human centric. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to talk about how that power is relocated by the ending of the film, it's definitely relocated back into human kids again.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, sucks to be an alien.
Yeah, exactly.
Cause you get to go boop in the corner and then blow up basically.
again, so, rip in peace, Akbar.
So, you know, I think, you know, like I'd have liked to have seen a little Twi'lek kid.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm just trying to imagine it and to think of like, imagine if I would have found it cheesy because of the, if the CGI were bad or something, but like, yeah, it's absolutely
not like, I'm not talking about like a CGI alien. Yeah. I'm talking about like old school Star Wars prosthetics, but as a kid, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. If you pulled it off, that might be worked better. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to kind of keep it, because ultimately that actually final image almost has, apart from the hyperspace jump you see in the distance, there's actually not a lot of Star Wars to it. It's like a stone building, a broom. Kid in.
I mean, it's Echo of Luke and the Two Sons, I think, is like, is Star Warsy.
Yeah, there is.
Not that just like a person looking at a thing is always an Echo of Luke, but.
Yeah, I suppose what I guess I'm landing on is I love the idea of that scene more than its exact execution.
Sure. Yeah, I'll go with that.
And that's because it occupies the most kind of production design flawed
world
part sequence in the film.
Yeah. Yeah, which I'm very interested to see that whole sequence again, because it really didn't work for me. I had no idea how I felt about it while watching it. And yeah.
Yes. And I think it's almost impossible to take this film on its own terms in isolation.
First time, yeah.
Both the first time, but also because, holy shit, it engages with a kind of unprecedented pop cultural legacy that you know.
We were having a chat earlier about what does it mean that this is an episode? Like, what is the difference? What do we, because you were talking about spectacle. This came off a discussion about, Laura Dern,
Laura Dern hyperdrive gambit.
But the idea of why do there always need to be so much spectacle, and how does this relate to the originals, and like why can something like Rogue One get away with less? And there's something to be said for what does an episode in a trilogy of Star Wars mean to us? What is the difference between something that is Star Wars and something that's a Star Wars story? What do we expect from these? And there is we don't really have time to talk about it, but like in an industrial context where these, as much as Jaws may have invented the summer blockbuster, Star Wars changed like what blockbusters did in terms of like imagining new worlds,
yes.
Like, seeing things you've never seen before. Like everyone had seen a shark before.
Yeah. World creation.
Yeah, exactly.
Just cinematic creation.
And the sense that in order to try and live up to that, these these trilogies feel the need to induce awe, which are obviously of excellent aim, but like tend to do it through amplification. They're the biggest, like the bigger Death Star, the biggest thing. Whereas the side stories have the liberty to live in the world, but like tell other stories.
Yeah.
I think it's not a question I have an answer to, but like asking what an episode of Star Wars means to us in terms of what we think Star Wars is an interesting question.
I feel like it's almost a bit like, its job is to expand and unpack and kind of set out the new set of themes.
Yeah.
In the same way that it has sort of both a kind of positive storytelling influence on the stories that follow in the years to come,
yeah.
As well as a sort of more cynical, like, influence on the tone and shape of the marketing and the merch.
Yeah, these are the toys you've got now.
Yes.
Like, these are the,
Here is your new Resistance bomber model that I have right there. Here is the new A-Wing. Here are the new heroes.
Yeah.
Here is the new fun aliens.
Like, and it does make you remember just what an impossible task it is. And like, as much as like, I'd be the happiest girl in the world if you one day get your own Star Wars trilogy. But like, I can't imagine that gig. And I think as much as like, there are flaws in The Force Awakens, I do want to give another moment of like, we're in this position because like of a lot, there's a lot of choices have led us to be in a position where we have like this new kind of Star Wars that also feels like part of the old kind of Star Wars, and like it could have gone so wrong.
Yes, it could have done. And actually, Star Wars is almost like, it's so great that Star Wars is being used as a vehicle for, not used as a vehicle, that's the wrong way of putting it. The Star Wars is an opportunity to get things right about pop culture, blockbusters, and things like that, that any film needs to try and consider, like, better representation.
The diversity of its class, the diversity of its cast, role of women, like, yeah.
Yes, like, you know, the fact that we've spoken for 2 hours, but sort of, like, only kind of low-key acknowledged that this is a, both this, that Star Wars has beat by beat over the last couple of years, and including, and especially this film, invested that universe with far more, like, it's gone from basically one female character to a respectable cast of female characters.
Yeah. A woman of color, actually, in this movie.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's happily something that this kind of vast entertainment monopoly is enacting across all of its iterations. You know, Rogue One led by a woman, Star Wars Battlefront 2 has just came out led by a woman of color. Yeah. Like, you know, like these things matter.
Yeah.
And they matter when they're enacted at this scale. And it's,
And hopefully it's testament to the sort of shit argument about against that it's like, it's distracting that we have only just talked about this now.
Yes.
Like it's absolutely in the film, and there's lots of other things to talk about too.
Yes, that's the thing. Yeah. And it's really lovely that it's being pursued with that, with a desire to do new things with it. Whereas like, I think the weakness of the prequels, even though they were very unlike the original trilogy, is that they were such a kind of grab bag of the kind of like sort of Flash Gordon-y childhood influences that, you know, Lucas unfiltered, because that was kind of what the original Star Wars was as well, was Lucas unfiltered, promptly then filtered by obviously people at Ralph McQuarrie and all the entire production team on the thing, but especially Marcia Lucas. And that filtered process was absent from the prequels, and it created this kind of explosion of basically like onanistic sci-fi making where nothing makes any sense.
Yeah.
And now these films are being made with both a kind of real world and series specific purpose.
It makes sense in the world, but it also, sorry, in the world of Star Wars, but also in the world of, like our planet in 2017, recognizing what it means to have what toy, like, not to keep talking about toys, but like, yeah, what toys are available to which kids and why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
A lot of kids are going to have those Rebel Alliance rings.
It's going to like those like ring pops, but like with like Rebel Alliance ring pops. It's happening probably.
Good. I think we've talked about Star Wars, The Last Jedi, for probably about 7 to 9 hours out of the last.
Bear in mind that neither of us have slept very much, probably ever.
Oh boy.
Are there any final moments in the film that we haven't talked about that you want to just give a quick shout out to? Or have we all
I
too
love
tired?
The line, wow, they really hate that ship.
Yes, I like
as
that
all
line
of
too.
The TIE fighters chase the Millennium Falcon. That was the one I was trying to think of earlier. When I was talking about the hanging bit of a lampshade on things, but it's like, yep.
They really hate that ship. Oh, the Falcon. We got to see the Falcon fly last night.
Yep.
Brother.
Yeah, boy.
We got to see Leia use the Force.
We got to see
Luke as a, like, training. We got to see Luke with, like, I've now said this earlier, but, like, I loved every part of his characterization and his personality.
Me too. We got a real complicated Force scion.
Yep.
Kind of triangle relationship form and be explored beyond simply, I think there's good in you.
Yes.
Shout, 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 fight, 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 right?
Yep.
Like that, we've seen the potential for actual meaningful internal conflict in characters in Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, people challenge the sort of just fly an X-Wing at it and blow it up thing.
We saw some genuinely wonderful fight choreography, I thought.
Yep.
We saw Adam Driver's nipples.
Yep. Gotta get,
That was necessary.
Man,
we're not going to end on Adam Driver's nipples. Well, maybe we are.
I think it starts where it begins. It's like poetry.
It's the begin to make sense, right?
Yeah. We got to see Poe's relationship with BB-8.
Oh, God.
And Finn.
Yeah.
You know who he's going to rush to and rub the belly of.
It's going to end with Rey rubbing Poe's belly.
They're all going to be rubbing each other's bellies. Yes, man. It's hard to land something like this because it's such a big thing. And I think I need that a couple of days later, second viewing.
Yep.
What an kind of extraordinary, mad, complicated, successful mess of a thing that is.
And as much as, yes, my feelings may change, some things I've said I've liked, maybe I'll shift on, some things I didn't like, maybe I'll shift on. You saw me, I was just crying throughout and like happy crying of experiencing a Star Wars.
Yeah.
And not in the way that I would, I don't think that's like an empty emotion that, for example, I didn't get it in the prequels. And I was a kid then. So like, you know, it's, I will like not to get too mushy, but I'm not going to forget last night. It was worth flying overnight for. Thanks,
yes,
brother.
That's all right. Thank you for doing that extraordinarily mad thing in order to stay up to 2 in the morning watching.
Sometimes you got to exit warp, Chris.
Well, that's us discussed Star Wars: The Last Jedi. Hope you enjoyed this one-off Star Wars spoiler special. Man, I don't know. I have anything else to add. Thank you for joining me on this adventure, Becky.
Thanks for listening, people who have. That's very nice of you. Yeah. We're very tired.
Hope you liked it. We will... Oh, I don't know how to land this. Help. Help.
I was just going to say, like, we could do it. We could have a Laura Dern, Carrie Fisher moment, but maybe we can't pull it off.
No. I think I'm just going to howl like a porg.
I can't make any noises reliably because sometimes I can make them, but they often come out the other side as like I try and do an RT.
What do you mean by that?
Shit myself, Chris. I mean, like I try and do RT when I make a Wookiee noise or something.
Okay.
So I was going. Great. Bye.